welcome to the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joined on the solar eclipse day by Dr. Daniel Shriver. What's going on?
Hello, David. I am coming to you from the Path of Totality down in Austin, Texas, where it is cloudy as a mother. Did not see shit today, David. It was taunting us today, for sure. I went down to the UT Austin campus. They had the total eclipse of the horns for the Texas Longhorns. Everyone was out there distributing glasses, and they had snacks. They had like bands, concerts. It was like a whole thing, and the sun just didn't show up at all.
Yeah, I'm a skeptic on the solar eclipse. Like, all these people I know, after the one that happened like 7 years ago, like booked places years ahead of time, and I'm just like, why do people care about this so much? It's so fascinating to me.
Because it doesn't happen very often, David.
Yeah, this is the classic, like, science enjoyer, not actual scientist move. I've never talked to a scientist who cares at all about this. It's all people who, like, know pi out to 1,000 places, but don't have an actual, like, work in the field of science.
Every 300 to 600 years, we like to be reminded that the moon is up there and the sun is up there.
Unless you're really, you know, Giga Chad brain and you understand the moon and NASA are all fake.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, so far I have not seen the evidence that this eclipse actually happened.
Yeah.
Some people in our Discord posted some very blurry photos, I must say. I'm not convinced, so we'll see.
JFK is up there, probably. A woman at work said something like the Aries are all, you know, fired up because of this is like suppressing something, something. I don't really know all about that, but so yeah, if you're an Aries, hopefully you're struggling through this.
Oh, no, I am an Aries.
what month is that? Does that mean it's your birthday this month?
Yeah, like end of March.
Okay. The God of War, man. You have to suppress your urge to go to war or something.
I am feeling particularly feminine today. I don't know if that has anything to do with the eclipse.
Couldn't hurt. Why not?
Okay. Enough chit-chat. Let's get down to business, David. So it's set review time. We did our absolute best last week, and we didn't even finish the two drops, as often happens at this time of the year. So, it's Outlaws of Thunder Junction, OTJ. We're going to try to finish it up, but they're not making it easy for us. They just dumped all these extra mythics and rares, the big score, and so we got to just plow through them all. But before we do, we would like to first welcome our newest patron. That is Colin S. Big thank you to Colin S. and to everyone else in the Faithless family. As a reminder that if you enjoy the program and would like to throw us some support, you can head over to patreon.com/faithlessbrewing, post whatever pics of the so-called solar eclipse, and we'll see. You know, we'll see.
All right, yeah, so we got through the release two drops at the time. I think the rest of the big score was getting dropped, so we have a few random cards from there, and then we have the threes, the fours, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yes. All right, but before we can climb higher, we got to go back to the zeros. Got some new lands, David. Talk me through Fomori Vault.
Fomori Vault, mythic rare land, taps for a colorless, 3-mana tap, discard a card, look at the top X cards of your library, where X is the number of artifacts you control. Put one of those cards into your hand and the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. So this card does not put you up cards, unless you have something that's triggering on discard, but it is helping filter your hand.
Filter, yeah, if you want to get like really imaginative with it, you could say it's a discard outlet for anything you're trying to set up. If you imagine Enigma Jewel is the deck you're going to play this in, you know, that's not a bad rate. There, it's competing head-to-head with a card like Murex. So exact same cost, you can just make a token. I kind of like it overall. Like, I'm kind of tempted by this to just, like, build around it.
To do what? I mean, if you don't have multiple artifacts in play, like, discarding a card from your hand just to look at the top one card of your deck is really bad.
That's not any worse than draw a discard.
It is. Rummaging is significantly worse than looting. I think we've demonstrated that conclusively throughout Magic's history.
But this is going to get me like my choice of the top one, two, yeah. five.
If you have multiple artifacts, then at least this becomes a consideration. So you have to be playing a lot of artifacts in your deck.
Oh, I will. Yeah, I'm going to have Enigma Jewel. I'm going to have Clues. I'm going to have it all. I could have infinite Clues with whatever that new mythic coming up is. We don't know, David. We don't know. Didn't you ever play Merchant's Dockhand? This is like a free Merchant's Dockhand on your land.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, though, like the comparison with Mirax is really tough on this card. Like, Mirax by itself can beat a control deck. This can never win a game. It can help you not lose a game. Also, Mirax can tap for colors the turns it comes down, which matters. For instance, Mirax can play the Jewel on turn one.
I'm not convinced that Mirax can do that. People keep saying that, but it's like the solar eclipse. I have no evidence that it actually does that.
I mean, if you don't click on the land, it just, in your mind, taps for colorless the whole time.
Yeah. Okay. I predicted this will be like Gaia Reach Sanitarium. Like, it will take a long time, but eventually this will just be like the best land for the job, and you know, you'll wish you had some in your collection. It's technically a mythic.
If you are playing Riel, this card gets a lot more interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, we love discard synergies. I don't know why we're harshing on discard synergies. This is great.
We're just naming a lot of synergy cards. We have to play like all these other artifacts that don't do anything except for spend mana to activate abilities. Like, we still have to play cards that interact with our opponent.
I mean, they're not going to make a land that's like obviously abusable. They're going to make you work for it. So that's true for Femori Vault. That's also true for the next one here, Tarnation Vista. Tarnation Vista enters tapped and you choose a color. It taps for that color. So it's a five color tap land. But the special ability, one and tap. For each color among monocolored permanents you control, add one mana of that color. Okay, so the big promise is that you can get a bunch of mana off one land. But each monocolor permanent can only contribute one to that number. So if you want to tap this for five, you need five different permanents monocolored.
Yeah, and they all have to be one color, yeah.
So it's not so easy. In order to break even, you would need, two? And then all it does is filter colors. If you want to get ahead, you need three different monocolored permanents. How hard is that, David?
Very difficult. I think the only way this sees play is again with like an Enigma Jewel, because it's already a blue monocolored card and its ability can be used to pay for this. So if you have like Enigma Jewel and Oath of Nyssa, I'm just naming two cards at random that are hard to interact with. Now this actually does tap for an extra mana.
So Enigma Jewel or an Omenhawker or even a Sunken Citadel.
Well, Sunken Citadel is not provided permanent with a color though.
Oh, but it like pays for the activation cost. That's something, you know, that's like a functionally providing.
And it's another coming to play tap land as well. Yes.
Okay. Spelunking is going to be one of our permanents. we're building it out. Yeah. It's a narrow path to profit here, but they're not going to make it easy. So yeah, this doesn't seem worth trying unless there's some random card that just like spits out monocolor tokens in different colors, which just sounds pointless.
Yeah, I have no interest in trying with this card. I hate lands that come into play tapped. You have to do a bunch of work with your permanents and all this stuff. And at the end of it, you just get a bunch of mana. So then you still need another card in your hand, right, that can use all this mana. So it's a lot of work and then it doesn't even do anything. You still need to draw something else. So these are the kinds of build-arounds that are very frustrating.
Next up, Conduit Pylons, ETB Surveil 1. It's an untapped land, taps for a colorless, and it has the ability pay a generic and tap to filter into any color. This is just a previously existing land that has changed Scry 1 to Surveil 1. Well, why does that matter? Well, we've seen that the card Enhanced Surveillance is actually like sort of okay if you just put enough Surveil lands in your deck. Now, in Modern, that's pretty easy now because fetch lands can become Thundering Falls. Would that ever be a thing in Pioneer? Well, you need untapped Surveil 1 lands, and this is like part of that base. The base effect is like not that bad. Like, I unironically played like Zalfarin Void for a long time in Modern in just like a colorless Eldrazi beatdown deck. It's a powerful effect to have if you don't have anything better to do with your lands. So that deck, of course, isn't actually taking advantage of the graveyard, so the scry versus surveil hasn't mattered, but I mean, who knows? Maybe that is something we can look into in the future if they keep giving us lands like this.
Yeah, also a desert. So if you want a tutorable surveil effect in your...
Oh, nice.
I mean, like, there's a few abilities at tutor deserts, as we've described, so...
Yeah, the Karu Desert will also bounce this and create another surveil, so that creates three surveils.
Yeah, over the course of three turns. And a bunch of colorless mana for you to do with what you will.
So, innocuous card, but it could be useful in the future. And with that, we move on to the ones again. We're back at the ones. Lost Jits. Jitty? Jit? Do we ever decide how to pronounce this? Jite?
I don't know how to pronounce it. I'd like to hear from a Japanese person at some point in my life and get it resolved. I've always pronounced it Jite, but that...
Jite?
I have no reason to believe that I'm correct. Pick your pronunciation. We will use that for the rest of the discussion.
That's a lot of pressure, David. So this one, LJ, my good friend LJ, now only costs one mana. It's a legendary equipment. It has the same mechanism. So whenever the equipped creature deals combat damage to anything, whether that be another creature, whether that be a player or a planeswalker or a battle, you put a charge counter on LJ. Then you can remove charge counters to choose smaller effects. The three effects to choose from are untap target land, target creature can't block this turn, or put a +1/+1 counter on equipped creature. The equipped cost is one. So this is fairly cheap. One to cast, one to equip. The question is, do any of these abilities entice you?
Untapping a land is kind of interesting, just because you can get your mana back right away the turn after you play this, but...
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to get in with a creature. So you have to play a one drop that doesn't die, so they don't kill it with anything. They also don't play a creature that can trade with it, or they just will do that with the Jit. And the end outcome of all this is, like, on one turn you can untap a land.
So the ceiling would be, like, charging this up a few times and then playing a land that taps for multiple mana? Is that worth doing?
Doesn't seem to be. I mean, in Modern, this is tutorable by Urza's Saga, so it's going to see a ton of play. Like, as a one of in a deck, it'll come into play a ton of times. So we'll see if it's, like, worth doing. There, untapping Urza's Saga is actually kind of nice, because Urza's Saga is a land that makes a Karnstruct.
That does sound fun. You know, Enigma Jewel is also a card you could play in Modern. I've seen some people messing around with, like, a bunch of Is It Signets and stuff and Enigma Jewels. You need something to do with all that, and Urza's Saga is a perfect place to put all that mana. That's probably not what will happen. It will just be a little bit of a lamer deck, but it's fun to dream.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need the +1/+1 counter to matter in some way. Either it's, like, you know, getting doubled through some effect, or... it getting put on a creature is triggering some other ability in some way.
Yeah, are we just, like, totally underselling the can't block clause? Because that's functionally a removal spell. Like, you put one charge counter on this, and then you just keep connecting by making their blocker unable to block.
Yeah, but, like, the turn... I mean, again, that just imagines so much more creature combat than happens in most games. Like, there aren't a bunch of times where your opponent just has all these blockers... Oh, wait, they didn't the first turn you attacked, right? Because we're always assuming you get the first counter on this. You can't even target Vein Ripper. So if they put Vein Ripper in play, you can't target it. Or, I mean, you can. You have to pay the iron price. There's probably some use for it. I mean, effects this cheap always just end up showing up in places. But I'm guessing it's actually going to be mostly like a modern card because of Urza's Saga.
So we talked last time about the Lava Spur Boots. Same cost, just gives your thing haste and ward. Probably just a cleaner effect to build around for one mana equipment. You always know what you're getting.
Yeah.
Okay, shall we move back to the twos?
Let's do it.
Pillage the Bog. Pillage the Bog, black-green sorcery. Look at the top X cards of your library, where X is twice the number of lands you control. Put one of them into your hand. And the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. That's kind of interesting because based on the colors, I would assume they would go to the graveyard or something, but it's almost just like a blue selection effect. Checks how many lands you have, you look at cards, and you get one to your hand. That's pretty much it. Now, it also has plot for one black green. Very interesting use of plot. Not totally clear why you would plot this. What am I missing here, David?
I mean, I think this card is... Okay, it's a sorcery speed impulse on two. This is a combo card. This is like a faux demonic tutor effect. So the plot means if there's a combo you need to go off on like turn four or five, this will find whichever piece you're missing on that turn and find it and hopefully let you win.
Yeah, it's a bold strategy. Like turn three, you're going to plot this instead of looking six deep and having a mana left over.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think this card is particularly good unless you specifically have a combo card you're searching for. Like, we don't pay two mana just to filter our draws unless it's in a combo deck. Impulse, as good as it is, which is instant speed, is only sees play in Lotus Field decks. It does not see play in any other quote-unquote fair deck. It doesn't see play in Phoenix or anything like that. So this has to go in a deck like Lotus Field where there's like eight cards that matter.
So apart from the confusion of the plot being on the card, I think it's actually pretty high ceiling. What's the most cards you could dig? We say impulse is the biggest number we can imagine, but all you need is three lands. This is digging six deep. Four lands is digging eight. Five lands digging 10. I mean, pretty soon it's, yeah, just like a tutor effect, but you can always just fire it off on two to replace itself, right? There's no restriction on what kind of card you're taking. Isn't that powerful?
You're always critical of tutor effects, so now we have a worse tutor effect than you like it, just because it's two mana?
I think I like it because you can just fire it off on... Nah.
I mean, that's a losing play. If you're like playing a mid-range deck and you just turn two, cast Impulse, I mean, you will not win that game.
Okay, so this is just like moving things between the wrong zones, library in hand.
I mean, it's like casting an opt with like more selection, but you're doing it sorcery speed for two mana. I mean, like Sultai mid-range decks did not play Impulse. So, I mean, you have to have very powerful cards you're finding because you are basically casting a limited tutor, if you want to think of it that way.
I see. Okay. So maybe not powerful, but still potentially very useful, like very unique.
Well, and there are combo decks like... Maybe you rebuild certain... So we talked about the one black, 2/4 vampire, and, you know, there's all these... There's the five mana card that just kills them. So maybe you play this in that deck, and you're just trying to assemble those two cards. Because you only need to resolve two spells to win the game. Like, that's the kind of deck that would want a card like this. Like a Splinter Twin-esque sort of.
Yes. All right, next up, Pest Control. White-black sorcery. Destroy all non-land permanents with mana value 1 or less. My goodness. And it has cycling 2. Even without cycling 2, like that's a pretty intriguing line of text. Just wreaks utter devastation on certain board states. And if that board state does not come up, you can just cycle it away. The only thing holding this back is white-black is just like a weird combination of colors. In Pioneer, at least. Now, in Modern, we don't care about colors. You can just do whatever you want. This card seems pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, the farther we go back, right, the cheaper permanents become. And, you know, if you think of, like, Vintage with all their Moxen, this card's probably actually awesome there, I'm guessing. I won't claim to know anything about Vintage. So that's super cool. Like, as we move forward into the future, like, we tend to pay mana for our permanents, and so they get more and more expensive. There aren't that many one mana permanents running around in Pioneer. Really, there's just red, white, Convoke. So is this like a sideboard card? Well, we don't really play black, white, period. And black, white already had a great sweeper for cheap creatures, which is that one black, destroy all creatures that cost two or less. So I'm not sure that this card is like going to see any play at all, despite being like very powerful, very interesting.
So the precedent is, I guess, Hidetsugu consumes all, right? Because chapter one is the same effect as this. That card occasionally is something, I guess mostly in Modern. It's a little bit of Pioneer play.
Yeah, it was very, very good against the Oven deck.
Yeah.
So that would typically be a sideboard card against that. There'd be two maybe in red-black mid-range of sideboard. Now that deck has basically been totally eliminated. They just cannot beat red black vampires. So if that it ever comes back, this would be a very good cyborg card there again.
All right, next up, Legion Extruder. One and a red artifact. When Legion Extruder enters the battlefield, it deals 2 damage to any target. Activated ability 2 and tap, sacrifice another artifact, create a 3/3 colorless golem artifact creature token. Kind of like this one, David. Kind of turns all your artifacts into better clues, right? If we believe a 3/3 is more impactful than a random card into your hand, now you've upgraded every artifact you have in play. And on top of all that, you get like a bonus shock when you cast this.
Yeah, the problem is you just don't have a lot of artifacts lying around, right? Like you actually would have to just make a clue. And then instead of drawing a card, you just make a 3/3.
Well, what if you made maps? Like, those are cheap. Those suck.
Those do suck.
Spyglass Siren or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. That's interesting. I mean, the problem is the front side is so bad. If we had a way of like getting this in play without having to spend 2 mana, then I would be a little more into it. Like 2 mana sorcery speed shock is our horrific effect. That's really bad. But I agree with you. If we had a way to get this in play, hopefully we don't have to pay 2 mana for it. And then we just have a steady stream of artifacts somehow, then it's a little more interesting. I do like that you can even sacrifice the artifact tokens themselves. So in a way, they're like resistant to spot removal.
Oh, instant speed.
Or yeah, you like chump Shieldred. I'm just making up a scenario, right? You block Shieldred, you sacrifice this, you get a new 3/3.
That's kind of fun. I mean, this looks really good to me, honestly. The deck I'm thinking of is you'd put together this Izzet shell, right? You had Gleaming Geardrakes in there, Enigma Jewels, and Omen Hawkers. I played like 2 leagues with that last week. It was like a really powerful core, but when you didn't draw the Geardrake, you weren't like getting the huge payoff. So I thought I needed like a second thing to like, really make sure I was always going to get max value out of my Omen Hawkers and my Jewels. This could be that thing.
I mean, it's definitely worth trying. Like you say, the ability is nice. Maybe because Bone Crusher is gone, there'll be a lot more 2 drops. We've talked about how good the 2s are in this set, so it'd be fun if we could play with this card.
All right. I'm going to get to work on this one and prove you wrong, David. I think you don't even need the shock. I think just like the rest of it is already good enough. I'm going to sack Experimental Synths. I'm going to sack extra copies of Enigma Jewel.
I don't hate that.
All right. We move on to Collector's Cage. 1 and a white artifact with Hideaway 5, meaning when Collector's Cage enters, you look at your top 5 cards. One of them gets exiled face down. If that is hidden away, the rest go on the bottom. How do you unlock the hidden card? Well, the activated ability is 1 and tap to put a +1/+1 counter on target creature you control. Then, if you control 3 or more creatures with different powers, you may play the exiled card without paying its mana cost. So this is always capable of just dumping a counter onto something. And then eventually, you know, you need at least 3 creatures in play. You can get your bonus.
I thought Hideaway meant that the permanent came into play tapped. Wasn't that a thing? They like randomly...
It was.
Remember there was some effect that had Hideaway and they're like, oh yeah, that actually means it comes into play tapped when they realized it would be super good if it came into play untapped. And we just, now we're ignoring that, or what's the story?
Yeah, so they put Errata on that ninja from Modern Horizons. The Hideaway ninja, they're like...
Right.
They changed the rules on Hideaway, but then they also Errata'd that to make it come into play tapped, which was very sad. Watcher of Tomorrow.
Okay, all right. That seems ridiculous to me, but fine.
But this is the payoff, David. This is the big payoff for the Hideaway change, is that now you can Collector's Cage on turn 3. You can potentially... I mean, you could flip on turn 3, right? Like, you don't need to activate 3 times. You just need 3 creatures with different powers.
Yeah, true. You can go Ornithopter, 1-drop, 2-drop, and then Collector's Cage, the 1 or the 2. I mean, this card is way worse than Fight Rigging to me, and Fight Rigging is not particularly playable in Pioneer, so... I mean, you need so much to go right. It's kind of wild.
Okay. If it didn't cost mana every turn, we can maybe talk, but...
Yeah, but it does. Then you have to have, like, a big creature in your deck that's hopefully playing a ton of little creatures. You know, you want some payoff. You want the Hideaway 5 to be worth, you know, some amount of mana. You don't just want it to be another, you know, grizzly bear with an upside. And then your opponent can counter this in multiple ways. They can kill any creature if you only have three creatures in play, because then you don't have the three. Or it can, they can kill the creature you target with Collector's Cage, and it doesn't get a +1/+1 counter. So this ability fails even if you do have three other creatures with different powers.
I mean, it's not that much worse than like a Luminarch Aspirant, right? You're still adding counters every turn. That's that mana cost.
I mean, it's significantly worse than Luminarch Aspirant, which again, nobody plays Luminarch Aspirant in the format except for me. So like literally no one is playing the card that's way better than this. Except for one man. One man dreaming the impossible dream.
All right. Next up, Vraska joins up. Black green legendary enchantment. When Vraska joins up, enters the battlefield, put a death touch counter on each creature you control. Whenever a legendary creature you control deals combat damage to a player, draw a card. What do you like here, David?
So two mana Coastal Piracy is interesting, right? We're used to four mana for this effect.
This is legendaries only, though.
I know, but that's what I'm saying is, okay, but if we're making a deck that's mostly legendaries, this, I mean, how many cards does this need to draw? Two? Then we paid two mana for a draw two. Okay. And then any future legendary damage. We've already seen the two mana legendary first strike unicorn. I mean, Thalia. I'm trying to think of other first strike legends.
It's just kind of funny that the Death Touch just feels like the wrong ability to pair with this. Like, Death Touch is not actually evasion. Like, yeah, they would love to trade your creatures away when you give them all Coastal Piracy. So, I don't know. Like, black-green evasive legends, they just don't exist, right?
Yeah, you're going to probably have to play white with this for first strike. I'm not sure that this card is good or bad, but there's a bunch of reasonable one-mana legends you could play, like Skrelv on one, this on two, and get a card right away. But yeah, I mean, probably not. It is a legendary permanent, if that matters. Untap your Jace.
All right, so I think that is it for our two drops. Officially done with the twos. Hey, and now we go on to the threes.
Yes.
So assume that none of these will actually see any play unless, you know, unless we really believe in them. I don't think there's that many cards that fall into that category, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I will say, like, we're not even going to talk about a lot of the legends. Like we talked about on the last one, the power in this set is all the cheap effects, especially the two drops that are super pushed. A ton of their three mana cards are three colors, a legendary creature, and then they have to, like, untap and do something. We aren't going to discuss almost any of them because they aren't even close, so.
Indeed. So ones that at least do something, well, the artifacts at least let you dream. We can still pretend that artifacts are hard to kill, although that's objectively just not true anymore. Let's talk about the Esoteric Duplicator. It's two and a blue artifact. Actually, Artifact Clue, because it has the ability to pay two and sacrifice the Esoteric Duplicator to draw a card. But on top of that, whenever you sacrifice the duplicator or any other artifact, you may pay two, and if you do, at the beginning of the next end step, you create a token that's a copy of that artifact. So let's just stick in the realm of clues. You sacrifice this to itself, pay the extra, and then it just pops back into play? Is that what I'm reading here?
Yeah, for four mana.
And does it matter if the thing you sacrificed was a token? Like, even if it's a token, you still get a copy.
Yep.
That's like a dream card with Tezzeret, right? Dream card with Enigma Jewel.
Yeah, I mean, again, you spend a lot of money to just draw cards. Like, this doesn't do anything the turn it comes into play.
I have this theory that the way that the cards are designed these days, you could just give every permanent in Magic the ability to pay two and sacrifice it to draw a card, and the game would still be more or less the same. Like, it's not that powerful anymore. So, just something about, like, the rate on clues is just, like, fine. You can have as many as you want, as we see with Duplicator. You can have as many clues as you want. You can have any artifact you want, as long as it's a clue. But I'm thinking too small.
I mean, to me, I'm only going to play this. There's an infinite combo here with Ugin's Nexus. So if you have a free sacrifice outlet or some amount of mana, I guess it depends. If you sacrifice Ugin's Nexus on your end step, and then you can pay two mana and copy that, When Ugin's Exes leaves play, it says you get another turn, and it has text on the card that says, if this is in play and someone starts an extra turn, skip it. So that's why you have to sack it on your end step. And then you start another turn because you sacrifice Ugin's Exes. On that end step, Esoteric Duplicator will trigger, put the new Ugin's Exes into play. You'll sacrifice it again to whatever your sacrifice outlet is, and then you will take all the turns.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
So to set that up, I'm going to use my Legion Extruder, and I'm going to use my Esoteric Duplicator, and I'm going to play Enigma Jewel, Omenhawker, Tezzeret, and just hope for the best. You think that wins?
I'm not going to play any of the cards you listed. I will be playing Stern Lesson to ramp to my 5-mana Ugin's Nexus. I'm thinking I might play the one black-black dude that lets you sacrifice a permanent of whatever kind you want in your end step. That's a free sacrifice outlet that's actually pretty sweet. It also just wins the game by itself because it does two each time.
Oh, Braids? The new Braids?
Yeah, the new Braids.
Interesting. So the sacrifice just has to happen at any time during your end step. That's the only condition.
Yes. You have to have two colorless up to copy the, or to pay the triggered cost of the duplicator.
So we're pretty far into the mana at this point. You need to invest 3 in the duplicator, 5 in the Nexus, and then an additional sac outlet. This is probably no threat to the competitive metagame, but it's fun to dream.
The thing that's nice, though, is your first several Nexuses can just be, like, sacrificed, right? Like, if you're playing Torch the Tower or whatever, so you turn 3 Stern Lesson, turn 4 Nexus.
Mm-hmm.
You could just sacrifice the Ugin without Esoteric Duplicator in play, right? Just you just cast Time Warp. So if you just play Braids, right? You just play Braids. If it survives your end step, you sacrifice your Nexus. So those are the kind of things that just end up buying you time because you get a bunch of extra mana that way. You obviously you're drawing cards, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's the kind of thing you have to think about.
All right. I like it. Next up is Loot, the key to everything. Loot, the key to everything, a legendary beast noble. Green, blue, red, 1/2. Ward 1. Gosh, those are terrible stats. This better have a banger ability to make up for those stats. Let's see. At the beginning of your upkeep, exile the top X cards of your library, where X is the number of card types among other non-land permanents you control. You may play those cards this turn. Okay, so it draws a million cards a turn, or it impulses a million cards off the top. Potentially, but it's so small. I just don't think this is worth doing.
Yeah, this card seems terrible to me. Like, even if you, like, turn 1 goose, turn 2 this, like, this is just going to die, right? Like, just shock it, pay an extra 1. I mean, like, ward 1 is not, that's not anything, right? I mean, that's nothing.
Yeah, when they make this so small, they're really, like, giving the opponent clear instructions. Like, yeah, just squish this dude. Don't bother reading all this card, just kill it. It's probably going to do something annoying.
This is one of the few cards that Legion Extruder is actually good against. It dominates the loot, the key to everything metagame.
Yes.
Yeah, this is the classic. This is the 3-mana legend. It doesn't do anything. The turn comes into play. You have to untap, and then you need other stuff to happen. Like, even if this resolves, if you don't have another creature or something in play, nothing happens on your upkeep.
I'm just picturing, like, the Commander games where, you know, someone triumphantly casts their loot commander and starts reading the texts. I'm just like, yeah, don't even bother finishing reading that.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like lightning bolts.
Lightning bolts. Oh, ward 1. I'll pay.
All right. And with that, we move on to the Lotus Ring. Lotus Ring. What's this all about? 3 for an artifact equipment with indestructible. Equipped creature gets +3/+3 and has vigilance and has tap sacrifice this creature to add 3 mana of any one color. Equip cost is 3. So 3 to cast, 3 to equip, and it makes the creature into a lotus. It also makes the creature like really swole, like +3/+3 and vigilance. So I guess you're attacking with a bigger creature. Your bigger creature is like untapped, ready to like immolate itself at any time into mana.
Yeah, it's a strange ability. I think everybody right away found there's an infinite combo with Cole the Forge Master, which reads when an equipped creature is put in your graveyard, it comes back to your hand. If that creature is cheap enough and you have ways to affect the equip cost, and if the creature has haste, then you can just make infinite mana. I mean, we're talking about multiple terrible permanents in play, also surviving, and you still need a spell that can use all the infinite mana. I'm not that interested in that. Yeah, you have a question here. What about just using this the normal way? I mean, a 3-mana equipment that just gives +3/+3 just isn't very good. It's a lot worse than the swords, I think. And the swords, as we found out, have not been super playable. So yeah, I'm not sure what to do with this. If there is a combo, I suspect it'll be actually in Modern, where you can just play one of these and Stoneforge it out.
Well, the +3/+3 is no good, but what about the mana? What if you could just ramp with your Fervent Champions into something sweet? Like turn one Fervent Champion, because that's the best way to abuse the Lotus Ring.
Yep.
Play your ring. Now you have a 4/4 First Strike Vigilance that can at any time sack for 3. So now next turn you can play what, like a 7-drop, I guess?
Yeah, the problem with that is, so you have this lower the ground like deck that's playing Fervent Champion, but you're also playing 7-drops, right? So what happens if you don't draw your ring that game? What happens if you have the ring but you don't have the Fervent Champion? That's not even counting your opponent casting any spells. It's just like some of the time the deck we're constructing won't do anything. And our opponent also gets to cast Shock and a Braid is a new thing. Thoughtseize.
Indestructible, baby. Indestructible Lotus Ring.
Yeah. So that's awesome.
But what if the big ramp payoff is like an X spell? Because that's going to be the finisher also in infinite combo. I don't think it's as bad as you're envisioning. Like, we should acknowledge that it is a turn 3 kill, right? Fervent Champion on turn 1, Cole the Forge Master on turn 2, Lotus Ring turn 3, and you've done it, right? You're infinite. Now, you haven't actually won yet. You still need that fourth thing. But that's turn 3. Like, that's not nothing. I don't know what the X spell would be, though. Like, Banefire doesn't seem like good enough.
I mean, why not? It doesn't matter what your finisher is. Don't even worry about that. The card doesn't matter. The assembling those 3 cards is the key. But like, how bad is that if you just do it the other way? Like, you just draw the Cold Forge Master, you just draw the Lotus Ring.
One of my finishers is the Gold Vein Hydra, because that also like likes being able to sacrifice itself. Lightning Serpent. You said we'd never want Lightning Serpent again, but here it is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to play with this card ever, but, everyone else is welcome to. Cole, the Forge Master, snap him up.
All right. Next up is the Sandstorm Salvager. It's 2 and a green for a human artificer, 1/1. When Sandstorm Salvager enters the battlefield, create a 3/3 colorless golem artifact creature token. Oh, it's a splicer, but they're not calling them splicers anymore. Additional ability is 2 and tap to put a +1/+1 counter on each creature token you control. They gain trample until end of turn. That's not that interesting, but it's like enough stats. So we've seen that this package of stats is like sort of okay.
Yeah, I think our first modern deck and our first week had Blade Splicer in it with Restoration Angel. We've played Malkator to like reasonable success in Pioneer. This is an interesting card with a card we're going to get to later that has like a native built-in blink effect that I like. This goes well into a deck with Asika's Chariot, which is a card that is already making tokens natively. Mm. So the ability on Sandstorm Salvager actually gets better than the first strike. Also, we've all been blown out on the Blade Splicer thing. Like, they just kill the Splicer before first strike damage. I mean, that's happened to us all. Those of us who played Blade Splicer a million times. So this actually leaves behind, right? Like, killing the Salvager doesn't stop it from after it's activated.
Yeah, it'd be cool if you're doing that Chariot thing, because they have to respect the 3/3, first of all. And then they've blown a kill spell, hopefully, and you still have a useful Salvager left over to, keep pumping up your cats or whatever.
Yeah, and just like the native ability of like blinking this or if you have any type of blink effect, and then the Chariot itself makes an extra body. So you can even wait, right? Like, you play this, they kill the 3/3, exactly like you say, the Fatal Push. We can imagine the cards. Turn 4 Chariot, turn 4, they go off and attack you with 2 Phoenixes. You crew the Chariot and attack, you make the third cat, and then you trigger this. So this is actually adding a ton of power, right? Like,
all right. Yeah, I feel like we need some kind of blink effect. Just making tokens is usually not enough, but it's an interesting new addition. You can put this on the green part of the color pie, and it's pretty safe for now.
Is there not that white card. We didn't brew. I think it's like Delny. It doubles the effects of one power creatures or something.
If an ability of a creature you control with power two or less triggers, that ability triggers an additional time. What a find.
So there you go. Turn one elf, turn two Delny, turn three Sandstorm Salvager. Seven power, people.
All right. Simulacrum Synthesizer, two and a blue artifact. When it enters the battlefield, scry two. Whenever another artifact with mana value 3 or greater enters the battlefield under your control, create a construct. That is to say, a 0/0 colorless construct artifact creature token with this creature gets +1/+1 for each artifact you control. So you know this isn't good because they tacked on Scry 2. Just like make it do something. But the dream is there, right? Like free constructs, all you have to do is get artifacts to enter the battlefield. We want to think of Affinity, but I guess that's not really a thing in Pioneer. So where are we going to get our triggers from?
So first of all, in Modern, this does make the Affinity, like Frogmite makes a construct. So like that's at least worth thinking about. I know we don't play those cards anymore because they came from real Magic sets, not the ones that let us exploit Modern players to help streamers.
Thought Monitor. The Frogmite is a Thought Monitor that doesn't fly, for those of you who have not played classic Modern cards.
Well, Frogmite is 4 mana, right? So it costs 0 a reasonable amount of time. You can imagine playing this on 3 and then like 2 Frogmites, right? So you get 2 constructs.
Sure. Yeah, and I was just translating it for the younger generations.
We have the ability, there is a 3 mana artifact that's like a 2/2 that is a Convoke card. So you can just go artifact, this on 3, play that, get a construct in Pioneer. And then Brass Knuckles, after this, puts two different 4-mana permanents in play. And those 2 4-mana permanents plus the Simulacrum Synthesizer makes Metalwork Colossus free. So that's kind of interesting.
Well, now hang on a sec. You're saying that Brass Knuckles triggers this twice?
Yeah, it makes a copy of itself. So you're putting 2 artifacts with mana value 3 or greater into play.
Okay, that actually seems very good then, because that's like the worst card in the Colossus deck, but you just like need to play it. So if it's already like just by itself pretty good with the synthesizer.
Yeah, I mean, I'll have a list proposed, but it'll for sure have 4 synthesizer, 4 Brass Knuckles, probably some number of Smithies. Smithy comes with its own construct, so again, that's 4 mana, and you get 2 constructs out of it. You get one from the synthesizer, one from the Smithy. The cancel, the spree cancel we were talking about, copies a artifact in play for 3 colorless and a blue. So you could copy a synthesizer if you wanted on your next turn before you play the free Convoke creature, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm. Okay, so constructs are an enticing payoff, and that means this is at least fun to think about. I'll have to do like another deep dive for free artifacts that you can do in Pioneer, because they weren't that convincing. Like, we'll see. All right, we're back to the main set. Wily Duke, a teen hero. 1 green white legendary creature, human ranger. 4/2 with vigilance. Whenever Wily Duke becomes tapped, you gain 1 life and you draw a card. Very slick design in that he has vigilance, so you actually can't tap this guy by attacking. So we gotta like figure something out. Now he's riding a horse, so they're giving you a hint here. You just put him on a horse, and then you can gain life, draw cards while saddling up your steeds.
Yeah, like this is a super cool design, right? Vigilance as drawback. The natural playline, right? We talked about that 2-mana unicorn. This is a 3-mana card with 4 power that can saddle the unicorn. So I'm guessing that line has to actually be bad, or they wouldn't just seed those 2 cards in the same set. It's just such an, and they're in the same colors. But we do get to play Smuggler's Copter on 2, which is much harder to interact with if we want to tap our Wily Duke. We also have that 3/3 that looks at our top card of our library and sees if it's a land and puts it into play. This can crew Chariot by itself, so that's kind of interesting. You can play other effects that tap it, like the 1-mana artifact that requires you to tap a creature to make a land, or excuse me, to make a mana.
These are intriguing lines. Like, there's enough density of vehicles and mounts like at the different spots on the curve that we can kind of talk ourselves into trying this. It looks fun. We haven't seen that many creatures that like pay you off on getting tapped. I think Amara Tandris or Amara Voice of the Accord was like the first version of that. And that was like almost good enough making 1/1s. This draws cards, so.
Yeah, I wish it didn't gain a life. I wish it did anything else. Like, not affecting the board is actually really tough here. Like, gaining life and drawing cards is what you want to do in a control deck, but and this has to be in a deck which is like a beatdown deck.
We'll come back to this when we get to the Felidar thing that blinks the things that crew it up.
Yes.
But before we get to that, let's talk about the Assimilation Aegis. 1 white-blue for artifact equipment. When Assimilation Aegis enters the battlefield, exile up to 1 target creature until the Assimilation Aegis leaves the battlefield. Whenever Assimilation Aegis becomes attached to a creature, for as long as it remains attached, that creature becomes a copy of any creature card that was exiled with the Assimilation Aegis. The equip cost is 2. So you can just forget about all that extra stuff. The point is, it's a 3-mana artifact that is an Oblivion Ring, right?
Yeah, that's the main thing. This is a Stoneforge Tutors for unconditional removal on creatures. Also, like in all these Malkator lists, these white-blue lists, we were always looking for something that could just, like, no questions asked, just take care of a big creature, right? We were playing, like, what's the 1 and a white get exiled creature that was 3 or less? That card is terrible.
Yes, that was horrible.
This is an artifact, so it's in all those artifact synergy decks. If you want to play, you know, whatever, the various effects now that look at the top 4 of your library, this is a removal spell that increases your artifact density. The crew ability is like, maybe it matters, maybe it doesn't. It's not a may, so if the creature you have under here is bad, maybe you don't want to crew something up. On the other hand, if you're playing like the 1 and a white 1/1 that gets +1/+1, right, every time an artifact comes into play, it's kind of cool to like, all right, we've exiled your Shieldred. Now we've got like a 7/8 Shieldred because we've got, you know, +1/+1 counters on our creature. So yeah, I mean, this kind of makes me want to revisit some of our like Malkator shells. Equips for free under Tezzeret. It's not like a build around. I think you just play like 1 or 2, but like you just replace. What was that 2-mana artifact, Dan? Mirror, or something?
Glass Casket.
Glass Casket, yeah. Just replacing 2 Glass Caskets with this is like such a huge upgrade. It's crazy.
Yeah, we had like the Dusk Rose Reliquary for another option, but maybe this is better. I'm not sure. Okay, next up, Aven Interrupter. 1 white-white creature, Bird Rogue. 2/2 Flash Flying. When Aven Interrupter enters the battlefield, exile target spell, it becomes Plotted. Spells your opponents cast from graveyard or from exile cost 2 more to cast. So this is a new effect, right? It's like a white counterspell. It interrupts you on the stack. It's kind of like a Spell Queller, but instead of permanently hiding it, they just have to like essentially pay the tax. Is that right, or is there more to this card?
I mean, I think it's this primary mode, right? First of all, let's just note, if you force them to plot a counterspell, that spell is effectively dead, right? You can only unplot as a sorcery, so the counterspell can never be used productively again. That's already worth noting. 2, there's other effects that we kind of like playing that exile things proactively. I'm thinking of the battle, the 1 and a white battle, which is a popular sideboard card for like the red-white Convoke lists. You know, we've played main deck 4 of those in various black-white and like red-white shells. This just makes that card even 2 more to cast. Like, you just can play this proactively. This also interacts, or like the Paulo card, right? Exiles a card from their hand and they have to pay 2 more to cast it. This makes an additional 2. This has applications against like the Discover mechanic, right? Every card that's discovered, this card makes them pay 2 more for. So in the combo days of Pioneer, this would have been better. Sultai Ultimatum casts cards for free when it resolves. This beats that by itself. If Bonecrusher Giant comes back for some reason, once they stomp, we can just cast Aven Interrupter and they have to pay 5 mana to cast their Bonecrusher Giant or whatever their adventure card is. It's a very interesting card. I don't know how good it is. I wish it had the extra point of toughness to be welcome, I'll say, but it's such a cool card. Like, Of course, I always love that two and a black that puts a card from their exile to the graveyard, then gives -3/-3. Like this card in that kind of white black shell is very interesting.
It's a solution for the Doc Orlok metagame.
Yeah.
I think on balance, I would rather just have something that I know I can slam to advance my board state. Like, kind of prefer Paolo to this. But yeah, I mean, Spell Queller is like a very important card. This just doesn't feel like a Spell Queller. So if I have to like wait and sit on my mana, I kind of want to just be able to like dump my mana when I want, not have to leave my mana up for like a 2/2.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. We'll have to see how good this card is. I think it's either going to be way better than we think or way worse. I actually don't think it's going to be in the middle.
Hmm.
Also, if plot is just an important thing that people are doing, this card is just very good, right? Like just as an anti-plot card.
Not true.
Increases 2 mana. I mean, of course, there's no deck right now that's playing with plot because the cards haven't been released. So this might just be like super important and standard against plot strategies. Yeah, we'll have to see. It is also a rogue, a relevant creature type.
Next up is Claim Jumper. 2 and a white for a 3/3 rabbit mercenary with vigilance. Oh, preview of the Bloomborough tribe. When Claim Jumper enters a battlefield, if an opponent controls more lands than you, you may search your library for a plains card and put that onto the battlefield tapped. Then if an opponent controls more lands than you, repeat this process once. If you search your library this way, shuffle it. So it's like a double Knight of the White Orchid? Is that what I'm reading here?
Knight of the White Orchid puts the plains card into play untapped, but mm-hmm. Yes.
So if we had 2 Knights of the White Orchid, I mean, what can we do with that?
Well, I think that the Desert Karoo, which we talked about last week, and Lotus Field in general, you know, I have built a handful of sort of fair-ish, quote-unquote, Lotus Field shells with Knight of the White Orchid, and it's felt quite good there. Claim Jumper's an interesting card there, right? Like, if you get 2 lands out of it, this card is absolutely insane. Like, turn 2, okay, we didn't draw our combo card with our Lotus Field. You just untap with just a Lotus Field, right? And then you play Claim Jumper and it just puts 2 more lands into play. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, that would be nuts. Claim Jumper, get 2 lands, play another Lotus Field, blink the Claim Jumper.
Oh, yeah.
It's like in the wrong spot in the curve to like really be like a great thing, but I like where their head is at. I like that they're willing to like let you have this effect multiple times because it's inherently pretty fair.
Yeah, I think this card is going to be very, very good in like casual white decks. It's just like a mono white ramper. It fixes your mana because it can hit any plains card. If your opponent ramped somehow, this card is also very good. But yeah, you have to kind of build around it. So like turn 2, you know, whatever, you tap a white mana, you Desert Crew it away, and then you just play this on the next turn. It does let you play decks with more colorless sources than Knight of the White Orchid does, which is kind of nice. Or non-white sources.
Okay, next up, we briefly revisit Fibblethip Lost on the Range. It's 1 blue-blue legendary creature homunculus for a 1/1 with Ward 2. Fibblethip lets you plot cards off the top of your library at any time. So you can look at your top card anytime you want. The top card of your library has plot. The plot cost is equal to its mana cost, and you may plot non-land cards from the top of your library. So when we first saw this, we didn't know what plot did. Now that we've taken that bite of the apple of knowledge, what do we think?
This card seems pretty good to me. So it's not a good blocker. And so in a control deck, it's kind of tough to tap out for. But in a more mid-range, like, tap-out style deck, so I'm thinking of, yes, a deck that has, like, Thoughtseize and Push in it. Like, every Thoughtseize and Push, you just put on layaway from the top of your deck. You just start, like, flying through your deck with these, like, cheap one-mana interaction spells. And then, like, a Fatal Push you put on layaway, you just wait till you have a permanent, you know, leave play or something if you want to turn on whatever. So I think if you're playing, like, maybe, like, a blue-black, like, Phoenix-style shell where you're playing, like, 4 or 8 maybe cantrips, +4 Thoughtseize, +4 Push. So you just have a lot of cards that you don't mind like casting at some point in the future. This seems pretty interesting to me.
On the one hand, we've seen so many of this type of effect, like play off the top of your deck, and it's usually never as good as I want it to be. But on the other hand, that's because you have to find all these proactive cards to fit in the deck. plot is like a plot twist on that, right? Like you can like put these cards into the exile zone and play them when you want to. That's a really cool design. I didn't even think of that because I'm just so used to like seeing a fatal push on top and being kind of disappointed that my turn is over.
Or even like just like you untap with four mana, you see Thoughtseize on top of your deck, you put it in exile. Whatever, I'm trying to resolve my 5-mana Planeswalker next turn. Like, now I just cast a free Thoughtseize before I cast Shark Typhoon, for instance. That's really good. I mean, it helps any deck that is pseudo-proactive. Basically, if you're playing Febblethip, you can't play Counterspells, which is tough in a deck that's playing double blue on turn 3. But if you're combining it with red, a black for the Thoughtseize type of duress effects, maybe that's fine.
Yeah, intrigued by this one. Okay, Fortune, Loyal Steed. So it's actually not a Felidar. I apologize. It is just a beast. But a Fortune,
it does look like a Felidar, though. I agree.
It does.
It looks exactly like a Felidar.
It's 2 and a white for a legendary beast mount, 2/4 creature. When Fortune, Loyal Steed enters, scry 2. Saddle cost is 1 whenever Fortune attacks while saddled. At the end of combat, you exile it and up to 1 target creature that saddled it this turn, then return those cards to the battlefield under their owner's control. As a reminder, saddling is like crewing, but it happens at sorcery speed. So you saddle up and you get like a bonus blink on the thing that mounted, and then the Fortune comes back untapped. You can saddle post-combat if you want to, if there's, you know, you're playing that 4/2 guy we were talking about, you just need to tap it as many times as you can. Yeah, do that on your turn, because it's sorcery only. Kind of at a weird spot in the mana curve, so that's a little bit of a drawback. It's not really a meaningful attacker, but, I mean, it sets everything up, right? Like, he blinks itself, and every time it comes back, it scries.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in playing this card on turn 2 after Mana Elf. So, yeah, I've got a shell here. Turn 1 Mana Elf, turn 2 this. A lot of cards you can follow it up with. Amara, Steel Seraph, Combat Thresher, Asika's Chariot. They printed the 4/2 dude we just talked about. They also printed the 1/1 that makes a 3/3 golem. You can play any or all of those cards with him. 4 toughness means you can probably attack comfortably on turn 3 most of the time without it dying.
So your prototype lion unlocks the back half of the prototype card, right?
Yes.
That's very attractive. And Combat Thresher looks great there. Draw 2 cards, get a double striker, scry 4. Chariot. Okay, so you play the chariot, you crew the chariot first, then the chariot jumps on the Fortune.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I'm into it.
So yeah, obviously I built this list before they had the 1/1 that makes the 3/3 and the 4/2 guy. I'd replace a card or two here or there because I have 3 Amara, Soul of Accord. I'd probably play like 2 instead. Still have Smuggler's Copter, still have Dromoka's Command. Yeah, I'm at least interested in trying it out.
This deck looks like it would totally wreck red-black midrange. So whenever that deck is back on top of the metagame, we can really get them with this green-white blink tech. It takes a while to actually kill them, but that's okay. All right, we move on to Gearhead, Mirror of the Wilds. Red, white, and green. 3/3 legendary human shaman with haste. And he's got a really weird line of text. It says, non-token creatures you control have tap, create a token that's a copy of target token you control that enter the battlefield this turn. So non-token creatures, including Gearhead himself. So he's got this ability. He can tap himself, and he's got haste.
And he has haste, yes.
Double up any token that was just made. And he lets all your creatures do that. So what are we trying to do with this?
Well, there's a bunch of infinite ways to win. So the base level play that I think is actually going to be quite good in standards is turn 2 Golag Greeters, turn 3 Gearhead. They tap them both to target the treasure that the Golag Greeters made. So that means on your next turn, your fourth turn, you'll have 7 mana available to you if you play a fourth land. So that's the baseline. That's with nothing fancy happening.
Well, the treasure didn't come into play that turn, though. Oh, it did. It did, because of the greeters.
It was triggered by the greeters. Try to keep up here, Dan. We're trying to build decks.
Sorry, I just shortcutted to like Prosperous Innkeeper, which is like an actual playable card. But I see we're not in that universe. We're in a Gallic Reader's universe. Continue. Sorry.
So the other thing is, if you have a Midnight Guard in play and you play any card that makes a creature token, Midnight Guard makes an infinite number of creatures. So if it's Resolute Reinforcements, you make an infinite number of 1/1s. If it's Registrar Alpha, you make an infinite number of 3/3 hasty dinosaurs. So Midnight Guard says whenever another creature comes into play, untap it. So let's just imagine it's magical Christmas land. We turn 4, end of their turn, Coco, and we hit Midnight Guard and Geared. And then on our 5th turn, we play our 5th land and play Registrar Alpha. It makes a 3/3 dinosaur token with haste. Midnight Guard triggers. We proceed to make infinite numbers of dinosaurs. Or we just play Resolute Reinforcements, and we just make infinite 1/1s. We don't get to kill them that turn. We have to pass.
Are there any tokens that come with an untap? Like tokens that let you untap something else?
I don't understand the question.
So that when you copy the token, like Midnight Guard is a card that like natively untaps itself. But what if there was a token that did that? Because Midnight Guard sucks. That's my issue with this. It's literally a common, so it can't be good. It's a 2/3 with pseudo vigilance.
Yeah. So anyway, I have 2 shells here. I mean, you can be like Dan and just only play the cards that are already quote unquote playable, or we can brew. I don't know what kind of podcast we're doing here. That's your call.
I just been burned by Midnight Guard, like in limited decks.
So another card that natively makes hasty tokens is Twin Flame. Same with Nahiri. So Nahiri makes a token that can be copied. Twin Flame makes a token that can be copied. Registrar Alpha makes a token that can be copied. Voice of Resurgence kind of makes a token that can be copied. So yeah, there's a ton of options here.
So what difference does it make if your token has haste?
Well, you kill them that turn or not if you get to go off with your Midnight Guard combo.
I see. Okay. All right, so it's a different payoff to the core. I mean, he definitely is like worth a lot of cards. Like even when you're not comboing, these are permanent copies that come into play. They're not temporary tokens. So,
and like a 3/3 haste is not good, but it's like also not embarrassing. Like it can just come down and attack a Liliana or something, right? If they kill your Gallic Raiders, they kill your turn 1 mana elf.
All right, so there's more here than I originally thought, and yeah, I'm impressed that you've already got 2 infinite brews just off the first pass at this. Speaking of like evil Pumbas, the artwork is very disturbing.
Yeah, he seems like a friend of of nature.
All right, next up, we have another signpost uncommon, and it's Honest Rutstein, 1 black green, legendary human warlock, 3/2. But they give you a lot these days on your uncommons. So this one has an enter the battlefield trigger that draws a card. Well, not draw a card. It actually returns target creature card from your graveyard to your hand. But that alone is like, you know, as good as we would expect to get from a 3-drop. And then on top of that, Honest Rutstein also says creature spells you cast cost 1 generic less to cast. So there's like almost something there where you could kind of talk yourself into either half of the card. Like we don't really see that blanket cost reduction on creatures. And we also, it's not that common to get a 3/2 for 3 that, you know, draws a creature back to your hand.
Yeah. It could kind of combines like 2 effects that aren't themselves playable, but if they're each like 75% of a playable card, maybe like jamming them all together into a card is worth doing. The problem is like the ramp you want down as soon as possible, right? But the sooner you play this card, the less likely you are to get a card back out of it, because maybe a creature hasn't hit the graveyard yet. So,
yeah, it always free casts your Hope of Ghirapur or your Ginger Brutes. So there's that.
Yeah, that's definitely something.
Yeah, my gut says that it's just like the stats are a little bit wrong. It's not quite cheap enough and not quite sturdy enough to like reward you for like assembling all the pieces. But it's a sign of the times that...
Yeah, it dies very easily. 2 toughness, obviously, is, you know, we've seen that happen. It does have a quote-unquote come-into-play effect, but, like, if you turn 2 elf, turn 2 this, right, you're probably not getting a card out of it because there's been no chance for a creature to go to the graveyard yet, so.
Okay, so I do want to ask you about Karavek the Punisher, David. It's one black for a 3/3 legendary human warlock. The text is, whenever you commit a crime, exile up to one target black card from your graveyard and copy it. You may cast the copy. If you do, you lose 2 life. So the best crimes are Thoughtseize and Fatal Push, right? And they're just like black cards that will be in the graveyard. So it seems like it shouldn't be too hard to make Karabekh the Punisher do the thing he's saying that he's going to do. Are we just thinking that's not powerful enough, or what's your read on this?
Well, it's a 3-drop, so it doesn't do the thing you want it to do. Like, even if you wait till 4 and Thoughtseize that turn, you don't have any mana left. You still have to cast the card. So this is a 5-drop when it first gives you value, and one of the cards you want to copy is Thoughtseize. So, like, multiple Thoughtseizes, plus the fact that this is costing you 2 life to cast it. So you're out 6 life just from your spells.
Okay.
Plus you have to cast the first one to start it. So you have to cast this, have already cast Thoughtseize, then I have Fatal Push their creature, and then you can't copy the spell that's causing the crime, right? You have to already have a spell in the graveyard, and you have to cast the Thoughtseize from your graveyard for 2 mana. The Thoughtseize takes another 2 life. So you're just out a ton of life, and it's turn 5, and you got up 1 card.
Well, what if I just, like, Thoughtseize, take the removal, turn 3, just play Karabekh? I don't expect to have it enter the battlefield effect. And now I just have this in play, and I can kind of chain reaction my crimes on a future turn.
I mean, maybe. Yeah, I just don't think that's very good. Like, it's not a fast clock. It's not good against aggro or control. It's not particularly good in mid-range matchups. Like, I just don't see where this card is useful.
4 Cling to Dust, I guess. I'm not sure.
Okay, all right. I mean,
that's... We need that life back. all right.
It is a warlock.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So was the last card we talked about was also a warlock randomly for people who...
So who are the good guys in this set? Well, there's mayors. Politicians are apparently good guys. Campbell, profiteering mayor. Not a warlock. He is, in fact, a human advisor. 1 white-black for a 2/4 legendary human advisor. Whenever one or more tokens enter under your opponent's control, for each of them, you create a tapped token that's a copy of that. They get a token, you get a token. That's only fair. This ability triggers only once each turn. Whenever one or more tokens enter under your control, each opponent loses 1 life and you gain 1 life. So they don't get their tokens, they just get drained. Huh. Okay, so these two abilities do feed each other, right?
Yeah, I mean, this card is super sweet. Like, there's a lot of native tokens that our opponents are generating, right? Like, they play Blood Tithe Harvester, we get a blood and drain them. They play Fable, they get a 2/2 creature token, we get 1 and drain them. They attack with their Fable token, they get a treasure, we get a treasure and drain them. Anything that makes clues, although you and I are basically the only people doing that stuff, but we exist out in the queues. Maps. The vampire tokens that the Schism makes, Shark Typhoon tokens, Emperor making a 2/2 token. That's just stuff that our opponent's doing. So this might just be natively good without us doing anything. Then we can build around this. We can play Thraben Inspector. We can play Get Lost on our opponent's creature, which has been shown to be a pretty reasonable removal spell. Now it gives us an extra map and drains them. We can go like synergy based. We can play like Angelic Ascension or like Dagger Burn style with like Trespasser's Curse and Dousing Dagger and like doubling come into play triggers and things like that. The one card I want to highlight that you and I have kind of been looking for an excuse to play is Tribute to Hirobi. So Tribute to Hirobi Saga, 1 and a black. When it comes into play, your opponent makes a 1/1 rat.
Oh.
And then the second saga makes another 1/1 rat, and then we gain control of all the rats, and then it gets to attack. And so each of those rats actually drains them for 1, and we're just increasing all the rats that we're making. I mean, that's just a card I've been wanting to play. This is the card that gives me, like, the excuse to do it, I think.
Okay, I thought the Guest Law synergy was super sweet, but this Tribute to Hirobi is even sweeter. Like, the card was, like, almost there by itself. It just hurts too much to give them the rats. but you're telling me that I get 4 rats now, I get my life back, and then I've got all the rats, plus a 3/3.
Yeah.
And it's like perfectly on curve. It's beautiful stuff.
Well, if you play it on curve, you actually don't. Kambal's not going to see either of the rats. But from the first tribute.
All right. So let a man dream here.
But you don't have to play it on two. That's the other thing. Like, sometimes you want to, sometimes you don't. But yeah, I mean, just this card with like Thraben Inspector or something like that, where you're just getting these random drains, like that's going to be good enough. And it, because it's natively good to get, like, you just can't play Fable into this card. It's insane. Like, it just dominates Fable. It's crazy to think about how powerful it is against Fable.
Yeah, the Angelic Ascension line's super interesting also. Yeah, Beast Within.
Yeah, and you could play the White Beast Within. We skipped over it, but there's a 2-mana card that destroys a artifact or creature and gives them a 2/2 bovine. This blocks that 2/2 very easily. And you'd get your own ox.
I like it. Okay, Kellen joins up. Green, white, blue, legendary enchantment. When Kellen joins up, enters, you may exile a non-land card with mana value 3 or less from your hand. If you do, it becomes plotted. Whenever a legendary creature enters under your control, put a +1/+1 counter on each creature you control. All right, so I guess the whole point is to plot something from your hand. I guess that's kind of like a ramp spell if you do something sneaky with it. Is that the main payoff?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are going to try to be turn two-ing Valky with this, right? Like, turn one, Gilded Goose, turn two, put Valky on ice for a turn, see if it resolves next turn. I also like this card with Flaxen Intruder, so people don't remember that. It was the first card spoiled from Eldraine. So one green mana for a 1/2. It has an adventure, 5, green, make 3, 2/2 bears, I think. So people typically have not thought that adventure is worth doing. Well, it's actually kind of worth doing with this card because A, you just get to cast it for free on the following turn, and B, this is like an overrun-like effect. So you do that, and then the next turn you cast, you know, a 2-mana Kellen. And then all your 2/2 bears get +1/+1. So this is both like wedding announcement, like pump, as well as a card that can cheat some of these more expensive cards into play.
Yeah, plot is so cool. Like, they just did all the stuff with plot. Plot, attaching it to cards that are not meant to be plotted, and then you unlock all of the stuff with the split cards and the adventures and the DFCs. It's exciting stuff. I don't think this card is, like, actually good enough. Kellen joins up, just because you have to have a thing in your hand, and that's kind of tough. Your card down for that. But maybe just, like, Fibblethip. Fibblethip wants cheap stuff, so what if Flaxen Intruder is your big payoff for Fibblethip, you know? That'd be fun.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, very possible. This can also be recast. So Release to the Wind, which is interesting with Valky, as we've talked about. You can just release this and recast it to get the trigger again, which is super cool.
But what would be the point of that, I guess?
If I have a Valky in my hand and this is in play, I draw Valky the turn after I suspend the first one.
I see. Okay. Interesting. All right. Next card up is Outcaster Trailblazer. 2 and a green for a 4/2 human druid. When Outcaster Trailblazer enters, add 1 mana of any color. Whenever another creature with power 4 or greater enters under your control, draw a card. And the plot cost is 2 and a green. So another very cool use of plot. So if you just want to have like a mini Burning Tree Emissary style turn, you just play this on turn 3, get 1 mana back, and, you know, use that mana to cast another elf or to have the Outcaster fight or something like that, and that's not that bad. But if you want to set up the sweet turn, right, you plot this instead, exact same mana cost. Next turn, you're going to use it as a ramp spell, you play it for free, get the bonus mana, and now you have like 5, let's say, and you're ready to cast, you know, something with power 4 or greater. Have we actually done anything here that advances our board state to the win? That's a little bit unclear.
Yeah, I don't know about this card. It's so strange. Like, it dies to shock, which is, like, kind of terrifying for a 3-mana card with no coming to play. I guess it has a coming to play ability that makes a mana. But I do like that if you go the 1/3/5 skip with Kiora, you actually can play 2 3 drops that turn. So you go Elf on turn 1, Kiora on turn 2. On turn 3, you have 5 mana. You play this, trigger Kiora, draw a card. Make another mana, and then you have 3 mana left, so you can play the troll or whatever, let's say. If Outcaster Trailblazer is still alive for some reason, it will also see the troll enter play. So you'll get like the troll plus a card for Trailblazer and a card for Kiora.
Interesting. I mean, yeah, Kiora also lets you go Elf into Kiora into one drop. So now Outcaster Trailblazer supports that line also.
Yeah.
But what is the shell? Like, is it a green devotion shell or is it some kind of beatdown deck?
I think if you're playing this card, it's more of a beatdown deck. There's another card we'll get to on 5, which is the Gitfrog. And this is one of the few ways that you can ramp to the Gitfrog without or while still having a creature that can saddle it effectively. The plot line you outlined is one of the only ways to do it, because you want to be able to tap your elf to cast the 5-drop and you want this to crew it up. I don't know if that's any good or not, but it just seems fun enough that I'll at least try it once. And you need to splash a second color. You just can't play mono green anymore. So you either have to splash blue or black. And the frog's already black. And on being able to play these cards and still cast Thoughtseize, Kiora plus Thoughtseize or Outcast Trailblazer plus Thoughtseize is going to be very important against combo matchups.
Okay, next up, Ruthless Lawbringer, 1 white, black, 3/2 Vampire Assassin. Assassins are outlaws, right? They must be.
Don't know. Don't care.
Professional.
Not going to play a single outlaw-related card, so it doesn't matter to me what the text of the cards is.
When Ruthless Lawbringer enters, you may sacrifice another creature. When you do, destroy target non-land permanent. Okay, that's pretty fair trade. Stats here are sort of plausible. If we're sacrificing something we don't care about, then sure, like, this is great. You keep a vampire density high. It's kind of a sacrifice outlet. Vampires have, you know, their own special vampire land plus Cavern of Souls. So it shouldn't be like too much trouble if you decide that your, you know, Sorin deck wants your removal to be attached to vampires. Like, now you have another card that does it beyond Bloodtithe Harvester.
Yeah. And we talked about the, what was it? The Lively Dirge, the card that lets you tutor your deck for a card and put it into play.
Oh, yes.
So this is a one of, and that kind of deck is really critical. Like, it is the only effect of its kind in the entire format, a 3-mana creature that can destroy any permanent. So yeah, I this card is going to be like at least as a one of in decks that have the capacity to tutor for the rest of the format.
Yeah, I can't believe they printed Green Sun Zenith in black on an uncommon.
Felt like the only way to do it.
So, seems like the card, we will be seeing this, not in huge numbers, but, I mean, it's priced to move. It's a very, very powerful effect. It kills any kind of permanent. It's shocking. Non-land.
Yeah. Oh, God. If it was a full-on Vindicate, this card would be insane.
Next up is Ornery Tumblewag. 2 and a green for a 2/2 Brushwag mount. Beginning of combat on your turn, put a +1/+1 counter on target creatures. That's Luminarch Aspirant's text. Saddle is 2. Whenever Ornery Tumblewag attacks while saddled, double the number of +1/+1 counters on target creature. So we know that, like, the turn you play Luminarch Aspirant, you get something back. So it's not horrible, but you're not really getting, like, paid until turn 4, which is when you attack with a Tumblewag. By that time, you've distributed 2 counters plus any other counters that were already in play. You could potentially double those.
Yeah, I don't think this is like a build around or anything. I think it's still worse than Luminarch Aspirant, but as like a 2 of at the top of your like +1/+1 counters matter deck, I think this card is very interesting.
All right, is that it for the 3s? Have we made it all the way to the 4s?
We have.
Oh boy. Bruce Tarl, a Roving Rancher. 2 red whites. 4/3 Human Warrior, legendary. Oxen you control have double strike. Sure. Reasonable line of text. Whenever Bruce Tarl, a Roving Rancher, enters the battlefield or attacks, so it's a Titan Clause, exile the top card of your library. If it's a land, you create a 2/2 white ox. Otherwise, you may cast it. So if it's not a land, you may cast that card until the end of your turn.
Next turn.
Sorry, your next turn. That's so important. Yeah, because you're tapping out most likely for Bruce, but he gives you a full turn cycle to, like, make use of the card that he finds. And then again, whenever he attacks, same thing. The oxen that he makes are going to be 2/2 double strike for as long as he's around. And of course, they are white ox, not blue oxen.
Yeah, at first I kind of dismissed this, but then it's like, oh, it's a come into play and it attacks and it's until the next turn. So this is a 4/3 that always functionally draws a card at least. if it sticks around, the Oxen are actually super threatening. And then if it comes into play and you granted it haste, you know, with the 3-mana werewolf or some other ability, it's actually just generating a ton of value. So I think this card's actually like a maybe. Like it's very reasonably like priced against other 4-drops.
Yeah, if you hit the land right away, you've kind of got like a Seeker's Chariot worth of power in play, and then it just gets better. Well, now I'm wondering if I build like an Oxen deck. With the 06 and make that somehow
deal damage with its power, with its toughness. I mean, you can play again Mutavault, we should always remember. Like, so now you've got this like 1-mana to activate 4-power land.
Okay. All right. So there's something here. I mean, it's still like pretty high on the curve, but yeah, Mutavaults can cover a lot of sins. Okay, our next one here is actually possibly pretty good. It's Colossal Rattleworm, 2GG for a 6/5 worm. Has flash as long as you control a desert, and it has trample as well. So 6/5 trample. So a serious combat creature. That already is like pretty strong stats. 6/5 flash trample for 4. On top of all that, if the Rattleworm is in your graveyard for any reason, you get the ability to pay 1 and a green and exile the Colossal Rattleworm from your graveyard. You search your library for any desert card, put that onto the battlefield tapped, and then shuffle. And as we've talked about at length last time, you can get 2 mana off of that. You get the Karoo Desert. All you need is 1 in the deck. So I almost like that even better than the creature half, but like why not both, right? So this is presumably checking all the boxes. How would you put this into a deck, and I guess how many deserts would that deck play, and how many ways would it have to put the Colossal Rattleworm into the graveyard?
I'm not going to play any proactive ways to put it in the graveyard. That's a waste of my time. But I think I'd play like 7 deserts-ish is my thought. 1 Arid Archway, 4 of the Hashup Oasis, which is even better with this card because it already has trample, so +3/+3 is really useful. Hmm. And then 2 of the blue-green come into play tap, do a damage. Yeah, the Arid Archway, like you say, it's like just a built-in card advantage that you just have somewhere in your deck. Casting this at flash speed is pretty useful, so you know you might even want to play more. You could fit in the colorless Scry Desert you highlighted earlier today as like a one of possibly. But yeah, I mean, you could make an all flash deck very easily, right? Like Growth Spiral, you can play Night Pack Ambusher, Colossal Rattleworm as your 4-drops. You can play Shark Typhoon. You're going to just ramp a ton throughout the game. Like they're going to have to kill your 6/5 either through trading. I mean, I think this is a real indication of the mistake they made by adding a 5th toughness to Shieldred. And now they're having to make these 4-drops even more powerful. So they just sort of like sped up their power creep on these 4-drops. Although maybe this card is just like wildly unplayable in standard and we've just entered a strange new world.
I'm looking to see if there are any deserts you can fetch up that like really finish the game. I'm not seeing much in that category. All right, well, I'm sure they'll print more. But yeah, exciting new card. This seems like powerful and grindy.
Yeah, and if you're playing a deck with like Night Pack Ambusher, Colossal Rattleworm, not that you have to play those cards together. Like, the more you just have this native ramp built in where you leave mana up, it just makes your Shark Typhoons, like, better and better, right? Like, eventually you're just going to Shark Typhoon for 10 and just kill them.
Yeah, so David's deck lists are available in the extended show notes for our patrons. I expect we'll see these deck lists proliferating because there's a lot of potential here in this set. They're selling us a dream. That includes the next card here, whose mana cost is black, black, red, red, so this is quite the card here. Akul the Unrepentant, 5/5 legendary scorpion dragon rogue with flying and trample. Sacrifice 3 other creatures. This is an activated ability. You do this whenever you want. You do this as a sorcery. Sacrifice 3 other creatures. You may put a creature card from your hand onto the battlefield. Activate only once each turn. Activate as a sorcery. Okay. So he can't sacrifice himself, but the turn you play Akul, as long as you have any kind of fodder around, you have a Traxa that turn if you want it, right? And then you get back whatever you sacrifice and then some. You have whatever you want, right? You have Emrakul if you want it. Gristlebrand if you want it. Is this worth doing? I mean, it's a lot of board presence you're giving up.
Yeah, so I tooled around with a bunch of ideas. So there is a 6-mana, 3 colorless, black dragon with Convoke. Because I want a way where, okay, Atraxa, yes. If you have exactly 3 creatures in play, plus you cast a cool and it's not killed or countered, and you have Atraxa in hand. But what do you do when you have Atraxa in hand and you don't have a cool? what do you do? So the Convoke dragon I was thinking was interesting because if you don't have a cool, the creature is tapped to cast the Convoke dragon, right? And the Convoke dragon protects itself. You had a cool line where it tutors up. What are we calling this effect? Feign Death or whatever to protect itself from removal. But then I was like, well, why would I even have the Akul then? I just play the dragon with the 3 creatures. I just hate the idea of getting a big creature stuck in my hand. So I was thinking maybe like Yadaro, that's a powerful creature that can cycle if I don't have Akul the Repentant. But just like hanging onto a big Eldrazi or Atraxa and like hoping my Akul resolves and then sacking 3 creatures to get Atraxa is just such a dream, right? Like, how many big creatures am I even playing in this deck? And then what am I doing if I don't have the big creature? I just have a bunch of 1/1, like I cast Hordling Outburst and then a cool or unrepentant. Like, okay, you didn't draw Atraxa that game. Now what do you do? Like, are my 1/1 goblins doing anything? I'm not sure, like, what's going on. The fail rate of this card is just a 4-mana 5/5 Flample. So the fact that like, it probably isn't good enough just tells you how insane, like, Magic has gotten. But yeah, I'm not sure exactly what to do with this card.
He's an outlaw, so you put him in your
outlaw. He is an outlaw. He's a dragon, if that matters to anybody.
Artwork is freaking sweet. I don't know. Fun build around, but possibly a trap.
Yeah, I mean, that's my concern.
Is that concern about cheating a card into play?
Yeah, you just need a lot, right? Like, if you're making 3 1/1s and resolving a 4-drop, you've probably spent enough mana to just cast the big expensive card. You've probably spent 7 mana to do it. So I'm not sure you're that far ahead.
Okay, from there, Hellspur Posse Boss. 2 red for a 2/4 Lizard Rogue. Other outlaws you control have haste. Those outlaws include such creatures as Akul the Unrepentant. Now with haste, when Hellspur Posse Boss enters the battlefield, you create 2 mercenary tokens. And as a reminder, those are 1/1 red creature tokens with tap target creature you control gets +1/+0. Until end of turn. Activate as a sorcery. So it's 4 mana for 3 bodies, 4 total power, 6 total toughness, and, you know, there's haste on 2 of that. I mean, that's enough stuff off this card that it's not like you're getting a bad deal. That's probably not enough, so you need more than that. So that's going to push us back toward an outlaw deck, which David has said he will not do, but this is the payoff for that, right? Everything will have haste now.
Yeah, the problem is the haste-granting ability on your most expensive creature is tough, right? Like, when you're playing this 4-drop, this is probably, like, at the top of your curve. You've probably played an outlaw, you know, you've probably played a rogue on turn 2 and 3. So, I do think that these creatures are actually kind of interesting. Yes, it's 4 power, technically, but it's almost like 6 power, because you can, like, have one mercenary pump the other one, attack with a 2-1, right? And then, okay, that trades with their Blood Tithe. And then you can have, like, the other one pump this guy so he gets to attack as a 3/4. You could, like, spread your power out in interesting ways, but I think this card is just a little too fair.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Oko the Ringleader is one of the first cards previewed from this set. You've been saying that you think this is still, like, near the top of your power rankings from Outlaws of Thunder Junction. Can you elaborate on your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, I realize with the Hardbristle Bandit and the Armored Scrapgorger, it's very easy to cast Oko on turn 3 and already have committed a crime. And so if we're getting to do that, we are immediately getting to get our card back from casting it. So we get to draw 2, discard 1. And then on the following turn, if you commit a crime again, we could imagine what those effects might be. You can plus him again, but if not, if you don't commit a crime, I think, like, my plan is just make a 3/3, play an Elder Gargaroth, Oko becomes Elder Gargaroth, attacks and makes another 3/3. And you just have, like, an insane amount of power, like, very commonly on turn 4, but Oko's already replaced itself. So, like, in the fail case where Oko comes into play, draws a card, draws 2 cards, discards a card, and they kill it, you're already ahead. So it's like a weird four drop that functions almost as a quote unquote Elder Gargaroth, if you will. If they don't kill it, if they do, you're already up a card. So you can play a ton of mana sources because Oko can loot away the extra mana sources as we get into late game. It functions like a, I don't know what you want to call it, like a Jace like card. But then it's also a threat because every creature we play, as long as we have creatures that can get in without Oko dying, allow us to just like add a ton of power to the board because the turn after you can just make the 3/3 and attack. Like you make a blocker for itself and then you get in with whatever creature you played.
All right. I mean, the lines are sweet, but what's the fail case of Oko? 4 mana. Let's say you weren't able to commit a crime. So now you're just paying 4. Maybe you're on the back foot and you're just paying 4 making an elk. You turn Oko into a copy of something, but that doesn't, he's not going to attack, right?
Well, the turn it comes into play, unless you have a haste creature, making it a copy of something doesn't do anything, I don't think.
Oh, sure. It's just like, yeah, I just mean like nothing's going to happen off that. You're just like making Garruk Wildspeaker and making an elk.
Yeah. That's right.
Maybe that's not that bad. So, okay. Well, maybe an Oko week is in our future. The last time we had Oko week, we got a bunch of trophies. I think we got 4 trophies in our first Oko week. So I'm looking forward to the encore. Oko the Ringleader.
Yes.
All right. We are nearly through the fours. Nearly. Let's take a look at Stoic Sphinx. 2 blue-blue for a 5/3 flash flying Sphinx. Stoic Sphinx has hexproof as long as you haven't cast a spell this turn. So the turn you flash it in, you have cast a spell, so it's exposed. But potentially from there on, it's like very hard to deal with. Is this like, you know, the new meta is 6/5 flash worms, 5/3 flash Sphinxes?
Yeah, again, like they're having to make all these cards to like fight with Shieldred. I just don't think this is very good, right? It dies to multiple 1-mana spells a turn it comes into play.
Oof,
tons of 2-mana spells a turn it comes into play. And then, like, blue-red just makes a Phoenix eventually. So even if you're winning the race against Phoenix, which this card I don't think will be, like, eventually just get a Phoenix in play and Phoenix blocks this. And if you get rid of the Phoenix, you had to cast a spell, so then they bolt this. And against control, where in theory Hexproof is useful and Flash is very good, they get to make a shark, right, for 5 mana. So they spent 1 more mana than you. They get to make a blocker that also draws a card. So yeah, I just don't think this is that good. I'm surprised people think this card is really impressive.
And what are they saying about it?
Just that it's like this incredible finisher and stuff. It's like you're just going to play it on 4. If you're way behind, your opponent's going to leave mana up. But I don't think they even need to do that. I don't think you have to worry about it. You just race this card very easily.
So a fragile 4-drop. That can like elegantly race in the air. That just doesn't sound like how Magic is played. I think a card that feels more up to today's speed is this next one here. Bristlebud Farmer, Burly Boy. 2 green-green for a 5/5 trample, a plant druid. ETB, create 2 food tokens. Whenever Bristlebud Farmer attacks, you may sacrifice a food. If you do, mill 3 cards, and then you may put a permanent card from among the cards milled into your hand. So basically, like, 4 mana, 5/5 trample, get a couple foods. It's a very limited card, but that probably is good enough. Like, I don't know, a very mid-rangey effect.
Yeah, I think you cannot play this as a mid-range card. I think you have to have some, like, major synergies here. So every time it attacks, worth noting, it triggers roots, and it is a plant natively. So that's, I think, the baseline is you probably have to play it with roots. It does make 2 foods, so maybe you want to play it with like mill effects. If you have another food in play, for instance, you can get back that 7/6 troll. What's the card?
Feast and Troll King.
Yeah. So like that kind of stuff, I think you need to be doing. Just like playing this and then hoping to attack is, I don't think, going to get the job done.
Yeah, it's an awkward spot on the curve, like, because 4 mana is kind of the top of a curve, so
right,
the foods
right.
are setting something up. I don't know, like, I'm trying to imagine what you would already have in play that could immediately take advantage of those foods. It's nice that he himself can like convert foods into permanents, but gosh. Okay, so maybe like a miss, a light miss on this for now.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to try it, right? It might play better than we think, but I think you either need to, like I said, be getting back the Troll King, right? Because this is like a reasonable card that also natively comes with two foods. Obviously, you're going to play Goose in whatever deck this goes in. Or you're playing the Roots, a Roots package of some kind. And then like this mills, it does help you find like the cat oven combo by trying to mill towards the cat and leaves a food left in play. The Roots thing, obviously, every time it attacks, plus this makes, I mean, plus Roots triggers when you get back the Troll King, plus this is itself natively a plant. So maybe all that together, there's like a tier three list in there somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. Next up is a Brewer's card. Greed's Gambit. 3 and a black enchantment, and the opening line of text here is a real doozy. When Greed's Gambit enters the battlefield, you draw 3 cards. Then you gain 6 life. Then you create 3/2/1 black bat creature tokens with flying. And that's it. So
it's pretty good. Value.
Draw 3, gain 6, make 6 power across 3 bodies. All right, there's a little bit of fine print. So at the beginning of your end step, you discard a card, lose 2 life, and sacrifice a creature. When Greed's Gambit leaves the battlefield, leaves for any reason, you discard 3 cards, lose 6 life, and sacrifice 3 creatures. So you're getting a bunch of stuff up front. You have to start paying it back immediately on your end step. And then if you ever try to get out of it, you lose it all. So I need to like figure out the path to profit here, right? I get so much up front. My payday loan. Like, what am I doing with all this?
Yeah, okay, so here's the options I've thought of. One is donate, right? So you play the donating falcon on 3, you play, it doesn't die, and your opponent doesn't kill you, and they don't put a 6/5 vampire into play, and they don't do, they play Fable. Okay, fine. We play Greed's Gambit, and then we immediately donate to them with our attack. Or no, it still doesn't work. Turn to... One turn later, we do this. We play the Falcon face down on turn 3. There's also red donate effects you can use. Okay, that's one option. Two is when this comes into play, we sack it right away with no creatures in play.
Okay.
So we discard the 3 cards and lose the life, but we functionally... If we don't have like a lot of cards in hand, if we have no creatures in play, then we actually are getting something out of this. Like we go up 3 bats and loop through our deck or something.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I guess.
I don't know if you're getting enough value that way. Whatever. If you imagine you started with no cards in hand, right? We play Greed's Gambit, we sack it right away with the trigger on the stack. We lose our hand, kind of let's say that. We don't have a hand. Let's say we lose 6 life. Okay, we're neutral in life, and then we sack 3 creatures. We don't have any creatures in play. How we're not dead in this scenario where we have no hand and no creatures, so that's a different question. And then we immediately get back the 3 cards and the 3 bats, right? And we break even on life. And then the other thing you can do is just stifle the trigger.
Oh, interesting.
When it dies. So we play it, hopefully sack it that turn or maybe next, and then stifle the trigger in some way.
So what if I take your idea of like letting both triggers happen, right? Just changing the order, but what if I just say I want to blink this as many times as possible to generate life gain, life loss triggers, generate death triggers and ETB triggers for bats. Like if I have like an Archfiend of the Draws or something in play, or not Archfiend, that's like bonus creatures, but like anything that drains when the bats come and go.
Yeah, that's interesting. You wouldn't want to reorganize the triggers then.
No. I just like let it all happen.
Yeah. So we play, you know, whatever the 1/1 ally is, right? And then we play this and then we blink it. And yeah, so each time through, we're breaking even on life and everything, but we're just draining them for 3. It doesn't sound that exciting if I'm being super honest.
All right, last idea. What if I just accept the gambit? I don't do anything to it. I just like play it for 4, make 6 power, and attack until I run out of bats and cards in my hand. Like, how much damage have I dealt?
4 the first turn, 2 the second turn.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too good, but if I play it on my hand.
Now, there are cards that like make a creature every turn, right? Like the one in a black eye that makes the 2/2 decayed zombie, for instance, basically negates the end of turn trigger from Greed's Gambit.
I'm just wondering if it doesn't actually make sense to try to keep a supply of creatures in play. You just accept that you're going to be empty-handed, empty board. And just play Hellbent until you draw your donates. And, like, you probably broke even, right? As long as they don't, like, have disenchants.
I mean, this is a Brewer's card. We'll have to see, like, what the options are. It's also 4 mana, which isn't, like, I'm not in love with.
Yeah.
Because it's really hard to, like, play this and stop that, at least that first end of turn trigger from happening.
Yeah. All right. Artwork is sweet, and kudos on the design.
Yeah, really cool card.
Next up is Hostile Investigator, 3 and a black for a 4/3 Ogre Rogue Detective. When it enters, target opponent discards a card. Whenever one or more players discard one or more cards, investigate. This triggers only once each turn. This is no Waste Not. I think Waste Not is just better. Although in theory, if Shale Dread just didn't exist, if they banned it from Pioneer, maybe you play Hostile Investigator instead in your Waste Not deck.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is by the time you get to 4 mana, in theory, they don't have a card left, right? So,
well, this is what the Gaiari Sanitariums are for, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is investigating is not actually... cards. Yeah, true. I think this card is too mopey. I mean, it's wild to say, but like a 4-mana 3-for-1 just like isn't that good.
It's cute that if you're just like looting your own stuff, you get extra clues. But gosh, the price is all wrong. 4-mana for a 4-3 is nowhere you want to be in Constructed.
And the whole point of Waste Not is their deck doesn't have any creatures that really die to all of the Phoenix decks 1 red mana removal. So
yeah.
This does. In fact, if it might die with a trigger on the stack, and then it's definitely not a 3-for-1.
All right. I think we've made it out of the fours. We're so close, David, as we approach the 2-hour mark. We move on to Harvester of Misery, 3 black for a 5/4 spirit with menace. When Harvester of Misery enters the battlefield, other creatures get -2/-2 until end of turn. But the useful part is the channel ability. It's 1 in a black, discard Harvester of Misery. 1 in a black, discard Harvester of Misery from your hand. Target creature gets -2/-2 until end of turn. So you just play this as your stomp effect, quote unquote, and now you've set yourself up for something, right? Potentially reanimation. Or you're just like using that. If that's a fine removal spell, then you have a nice modal card here that's like trades early and is a body late. But probably where we would go first is like some kind of like not Living End concept, but maybe just like reanimation, like this plus the Carnosaur from 2 sets ago gives you enough stuff that like natively puts itself in the graveyard.
Yeah, you don't have to be all in on it either, right? You just have a couple of 5-mana reanimation effects that will eventually get this back. This is also like a sweet tutor target. You know, if you're playing like the... There's a wide variety of creature tutors in this set. Like, if you can play this on 4 mana and you just, like, dominate your aggro opponent, like, this is so good, right? It just kills the prowess creatures that are cost 1. It borderline wipes the board of Convoke shells, etc. So, as a reanimation target, it's interesting in that way. So, I'm not sure exactly where this goes, but this is, like, a really cool card, very unique effect. What deck we build it in, we'll have to futz around with it a bit.
Is -2/-2 at all useful in Pioneer?
Oh yeah, it's good against Convoke. It's going to be very good against Heroic. It's going to be good against all the like low to the ground red decks.
Stomp is back, baby. Stomp is back.
Could be. I mean, people now can just play their cheap creatures because red-black doesn't play Stomp anymore. But you will have the technology.
Exactly. All right, next up, you've X'd this one out, David, and I'm not sure why. It's Memory Vessel. It's 3 red, red artifact for like a memory jar. It's tap, exile Memory Vessel. Each player exiles the top 7 cards of their library. Until your next turn, players may play cards they exile this way, and they can't play cards in their hand. Activate only as a sorcery. You're not feeling this one? I mean, for me, like, this slight tweak to the templating of Memory Jar means that you actually don't really have to build around it. Like, I've hypothesized that most decks, like the average deck, cannot use this effect that well. So as long as your deck is built up to like play most of your 7 cards, you're just going to get more out of this than your opponent will.
Yeah, you just can't spend your 5th turn doing nothing.
Well, I'm setting up.
I mean, that's my problem. 5 mana, do nothing. Your turn. Oh, luckily you didn't have a counterspell. You didn't Thoughtseize it, and you aren't attacking me with any creatures. Oh, I get to untap and then do this. Like, I just there's no reason to be doing that.
So for you, the price is wrong. It's not that the effect is bad. It's just too expensive.
Yeah, the effect is great. I mean, if this was a 3 mana card, it would be banned before it was ever released. But it's a 5 mana card.
Well, Renan Weaponsmith, we have plenty of ways to generate artifact specific mana. Does that not intrigue you?
No.
No.
I still want my 5 drop to affect the board.
Okay, fine.
I mean, what are you going to do with it? Okay, you now you're going to use the cards. What are the cards that you're going to use?
Dig for more Renown Weaponsmiths and more Memory Vessels.
Yes, I mean, yeah, it sounds fun.
All right, so you need your artifact to affect the board. All right, so Memory Vessel is out.
Yes.
Let's go to the next one here.
Yes.
Territory Forge, another 5-man artifacts. And it affects the board, David. It affects the board.
It's exactly what I want to be doing.
It's actually kind of a sweet design, pretty elegant. It's 4 and a red artifact. When Territory Forge enters the battlefield, if you cast it, exile target artifact or land. Territory Forge has all activated abilities of the exiled card. So at the baseline, you just get one of their lands, and it's like you did a frenzied tilling or something. You got your own land untapped. For artifacts, you stole their artifact. That's not that huge of an effect for 5 mana. Like, given that it's only going to take out artifacts and lands, it feels like a slow resource advantage card. Not really. It's not an answer, per se.
Yeah, well, I mean, it does exile Ring and gain Ring's abilities, the One Ring. So that is very interesting.
So do you want to accelerate this into play?
I mean, if you exile Ring with this, you are... You are on top of the world. You can also have this and Ring in play because it doesn't take its name.
Okay. I guess, like, how close is this to, like, an actual removal spell? Or is this just, like, a fun land destruction thing?
I don't think of it as a removal spell. I think of this as, like, the top end of your, like, Buzz Crusher, this, the one in a red, destroy target, you know, land, your opponent gets to search for a basic. Like, you're just going all the way up the curve, like attacking their mana.
And they snuck in that if you cast it clause, so you're not going to do your teleportation circle shenanigans with this.
No, which is good. That's fine.
Okay. Moving on. Geesa the Hellraiser, 3 black legendary creature, human warlock, 4/4, ward 2, and pay 2 life. So, exceptional ward. Skeletons and zombies you control get +1/+1 and have menace. Whenever you commit a crime, create 2 tapped 2/2 blue and black zombie rogue creature tokens. This ability triggers only once each turn. So when you add all that up, you're paying 5 mana. You're getting a 4/4, but you haven't really gotten like material advantage yet. You really need to commit crimes before Geesa pays you off. When is that going to happen? Is that going to happen on turn 5, or is that going to happen on a future turn? I guess the other way to get paid off is to have a bunch of skeletons and zombies in play so that the turn you play Geesa the Hellraiser, you like suddenly have a huge board.
Yeah, I mean, that second thing obviously could happen, but I don't think we've got like the bones of an interesting skeleton zombie deck. I do think that this is more like an army in a can. And if you have like a Graveyard Trespasser or a Liliana, some kind of Planeswalker that for no mana commits a crime, the turn this comes into play, then you've got like a super Grave Titan, and a 1 mana cheaper Grave Titan is really impressive. Grave Titan is not a legal card in Pioneer. The Titans would be really awesome in the format. this is like a Grave Titan with protection, and it also pumps the tokens it makes. So that's at least worth thinking about. Five mana is a lot, as Law 11 has told us. This is a very fair card, but as like an interesting top end, it's at least worth doing, or at least thinking about.
Would you play Tiny Bones Joins Up, or is that too far?
You'd have to decide how good this card is, and at that point, I think everything's on the table. You're hoping that your like finisher doesn't need you to play other bad cards to make it good, though, right? Like Liliana is just a good card. You know, Graveyard Trespass is just a good card. Like, I'm hoping I don't have to play cards I already don't want to play in my like black X mid-range, you know, interactive deck.
Yeah, five mana is tough. Like, the game is pretty far advanced by the time Gisa comes down, so.
But, I mean, for instance, it does a lot more to affect the board than Memory Vessel, just so we're clear. Memory Vessel, you got all the time in the world. It's not even a creature with no ward or anything. That's a fine five mana play. But Gisa, who comes with a body with ward protection, that's like, oh, the game's almost over. What can we do?
Well, they're tapped bodies. Two tapped
bodies. She's a body, though. Gisa is a 4/4 with multiple wards.
All right. We're making our way through the fives. We move on to Rakdos. Or specifically, Rakdos Joins Up. 3 black-red legendary enchantment. When Rakdos Joins Up enters, return target creature card from your graveyard to the battlefield with 2 additional +1/+1 counters on it. As we discussed frequently, 5 mana is like about what you're going to pay for unconditional reanimation, and this gives you bonus counters. Second line of text, whenever a legendary creature you control dies, Rakdos Joins Up deals damage equal to that creature's power to target opponent. Okay, so we're actually getting somewhere here. This could potentially end the game.
Yeah, like you could get the Mole, right, which comes with a large amount of native power. You could get the Git Frog and whatever combo. It has 18 power. With this, it comes to 20 power. So if it dies, they die.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So you could play a Sack Outlet. You could imagine that deck. So I think you need to be doing something like that. 5 mana reanimation, as you say, is the going rate in Pioneer. And it is not good enough. There is no reanimation deck. There are no 5 mana reanimation spells. This is something you can basically barely even do in Standard. So I think you need to have some way to be turning the second ability there into a very quick kill after this spell, if it resolves. Yargle and Bargle? What the hell is it called? What's the 18? It's a joke that I don't know the names of these cards, but it's a 6 mana black-green
Yargle
legend.
Yargle and Bargle. Yeah.
It's a Yargle, right?
Yargle Multani.
Yeah, there you go.
Multiple 5-0s in Modern with Yargle and Multani.
So yeah, we know this card's playable. So yeah, with the Sack Outlet, this is a 5 mana win the game. That's where I want to... I mean, that's interesting.
And that's, you can do that at Pioneer. Yeah, I mean, that's actually not that bad, actually. 18-6 comes back as 28. All right.
Yeah, so it's not a trigger either. Like, if your Sack Outlet is alive, maybe it's not a, maybe it's the book. So it's not a creature. You don't have to play any other creatures. You just tap the book to sack your thing and it's over.
Wait, what book?
1 and a black, tap, sacrifice an artifact or creature, draw a card, then you can like flip it if you don't have a hand.
That's right. Rakdosak Staple, Terry.
The 4 of in red black sacrifice. You don't remember this guy?
Oh, I do. Yeah, I was looking that up earlier because I thought it would work with that Ugin's Nexus line you were describing, but it is only sorcery speed, unfortunately.
Yeah. So yeah, like there you can play a deck that basically dodges all normal removal. So that's kind of interesting.
You can also pair the legendary enchantments with their titular or eponymous legends. So Rakdos the Muscle is also 5 mana. It's 2 black-red for the 6/5 legendary demon mercenary with flying and trample. Whenever you sacrifice another creature, not himself, exile cards equal to its mana value from the top of target player's library until your next end step, you may play those cards. Mana of any type can be spent to cast those spells. Activated ability, sacrifice another creature. Rakdos the Muscle gains indestructible until end of turn. Tap it, activate only once each turn. So, it's a lot of mana to like get this all set up. It implies you have other stuff that you're willing to trade away for impulsive draw. None of that seems particularly likely. It is nice that if you're after Protect Rakdos, you just activate his final ability. He gets indestructible, he taps, and then you know, you have until your next end step to like make good on the cards that were unlocked by doing that.
Yeah, so I think of this card being played maybe like in a Jund shell, so you can play like Sylvan Carry Added. So Sylvan Carry Added is hexproof, so it's going to stay around, and then it basically makes like Rakdos the Muscle immune to your opponent's first removal spell. So, right, I go to attack with Rakdos, they either let me attack or not. If they let me attack, I can attack with Rakdos. I can make Rakdos indestructible after its attack, so the tapping effect is not going to be a negative, and then I get two cards from my opponent or myself if I want. The other thing I was thinking is, if you have some kind of loop where you're sacking something over and over again, this does win because it mills out your opponent, just exiles their library.
Oh, interesting. So whenever you sacrifice another creature for any reason.
Yeah, so sometimes we describe these loops, right, where you're just sacking a creature over and over again. Now, I don't know why you'd want one of your combo pieces to be a 5-mana, kind of hard to cast legend, but maybe it's like your fair plan, right? Because it's also like just a fine creature. If you play it on turn 4 with the Sylvan Carry Added, this card is actually quite good, right? Dominates combat, can attack into or block Vein Ripper very easily. Very hard for, like, Red Black can't get rid of it as long as you have another creature in play. So, we end up not ever liking these 5-mana cards very much, but this one is like close-ish, is I guess what I'm saying.
Hmm. Yeah, you make a note that Korvald is most likely just better. That's probably true.
Yeah.
Rakdos is trying. Okay, if you're going to pay 5, it should probably have haste, so that means the Gitrog is at least in consideration. New Gitrog monster. This time, he's a mount. So Gitrog Ravenous Ride. 3, black, green. 6/5, legendary frog horror mount with trample and haste. The saddle is 1. Whenever the Gitrog, Ravenous Ride, deals combat damage to a player, you may sacrifice a creature that saddled at this turn. If you do, draw X cards, then put up to X land cards from your hand onto the battlefield tapped, where X is the sacrificed creature's power. So, this came up in our previous episode because this is the cleanest way to capitalize on that mana dork that taps for 2 for mounts. But if you're trying to actually like specifically build around this ability, what would you be thinking?
I want this to be able to come into play in saddle right away, right? So the mount lets us cast it earlier. That's not terrible, but you know, we mentioned the Outcaster Trailblazer and I guess Honest Rutstein, but there's a handful of cards that let you ramp, do the 1/3/5 skip, but also give you a body that's still untapped because Elf has to tap for a mana to saddle this. So Topiary Stomper, Honest Rutstein, and Plotted Outcast Trailblazer are all ways to do that. So I don't think this card's going to be good enough. I don't actually think like a 6/5 Trample Haste is all that good. But if it is going to be good enough, we should do the saddle thing as much as possible and just see if that's worth doing. So you just like turn 1 Elf, turn 2 Topiary Stomper, turn 3 this crew with Topiary Stomper. If it gets in, we get to sack the Stomper, draw 4, play up to 4 lands, and just see where that takes us. I don't know if that's going to be good enough. I suspect it will not be, but it's at least interesting. It's a little different effect. Plays around Rass, right? Turns other creatures in play into something. And then your elves in the future can all crew up the frog after that turn, because in theory you won't need the mana. The Topiary Stomper will have been turned into, you know, a land or two.
Yeah, and there's not really any trick to the trigger, right? Just like have something with power that you can sacrifice. It just draws cards. You don't have to like have a density of lands or anything like that. You can just like say, hey, I got 4 cards off my Topiary Stomper.
Yeah, exactly. It's just drawing 4 cards, and then it like, you know, functions as like a growth spiral for the lands you do draw. It turns into like a native ramp. And it's nice, like, you wait till it does damage, right? So you don't have to decide to sack at some weird time. Just like you hit for 6 and then, okay. Or even 1, right? So if they block this with Vein Ripper, this still does damage to them. And so it doesn't count how much damage it does. As long as it does 1, it turns a Topiary Stomper or whatever you crewed it with. Your Outcast Trailblazer into hopefully some value.
Very interesting. So are we going to see Yargle and Multani team up with a Gitrog to draw 18 cards?
That actually sounds pretty sweet. I wouldn't be opposed to such an activity.
I mean, you have a note here about Thalia. Like, what the hell happened, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Where's Thalia?
I noticed she's gone, and this thing's even bigger than 4/4.
Licking his lips.
He gained almost 2 power and 1 toughness.
Oh, my God. Is that what happened? Jeez.
I missed Thalia already.
All right, we are nearing the end. Have we made it to the sixes, David?
Yes.
Okay, Calamity, Galloping Inferno. 4 red, legendary creature, Horse Mount. 4/6 with haste, saddle is 1. Whenever Calamity, Galloping Inferno attacks while saddled, choose a non-legendary creature that saddled it this turn. Create a tapped and attacking token that's a copy of it. Sacrifice that token at the beginning of the next end step. Repeat this process once. So that's, what does that mean? Repeat which process exactly?
Choosing a non-legendary creature that settled it and creating a tapped and attacking token and sacrificing that token at the beginning of the next end step.
Oh, I see. So you could potentially have multiple creatures settling at the same time. And then you
Well, you can choose the same one over and over again. You only have to saddle with one creature and you will get 2 copies of it attacking.
Gotcha. Okay, and this card presumably works within the rules. There was some philosophical discussion of whether you just have to keep repeating over and over again. Let's assume that you don't.
I mean, repeat this process once. There's no repeat this over and over again.
Well, yeah, but then it's like, you know, that's part of the process. So it's a trigger that never ends. The process. It's all about the process. Continuous quality improvement, David. All right, so what do we do with this?
I mean, I don't think this card is good enough, but there are like one mana or one spell kind of I win. Like we talked about that white spree card that brings back mounts for 4. It could bring back a creature for an additional 2. And this plus Terror of the Peaks, which is reprinted, but is already in Pioneer anyway, does just kill them. Makes a terror, makes a second terror. So you're attacking for 10. They see each other. They trigger. I mean, now a 6-mana sorcery that requires 2 specific cards in your graveyard. I mean, that's asking for a lot. I don't really think that's Pioneer playable. I don't think that this just bringing this back on 4 mana with the spree card is good enough. Just a 4/6 haste is a little doofy. Even if like next turn we have some powerful creature to play. So I don't know what to do with it, but we do have a way to cheat mounts into play. You know, we can make this 4 mana instead of 6. This is the most expensive of the rare mounts, so it's at least worth thinking about, but I just don't think it's going to be there on power level.
Agreed. I feel like the mounts is going to be like a green white limited. Going into red, it's like super sweet, but it's not going to make it into our decks. I think
I thought the mounts was going to be actually kind of a cool mechanic, and then when they printed the 2-mana 2/2 that makes an angel and then the 4/2 that taps a draw card and crew the thing. It's like they just wouldn't print those cards like that if they actually thought this mechanic was good. So now I'm actually not convinced we should like do the mount thing at all. Like if that's not even going to be good enough for standard, and it absolutely shouldn't be if they're just printing those are the 2 Selesnya rares. They just go together. So I'm kind of off it. They gave away the game.
All right, that brings us to our final card of the Outlaws of Thunder Junction set review. At the very top of the mana curve, and yet it actually has a chance because it's got cost reduction, so it's actually potentially a 1-drop. That's Hollow Marauder. It's 6 and a black, 4/2 Spectre Rogue. The spell costs 1 less to cast for each creature card in your graveyard. So, I mean, there you go. Get 6 creatures in the graveyard, and it only costs a single black. What do you get for all this setup? Well, it's a 4/2 flying. When Hollow Marauder enters, any number of target opponents each discard a card. For each of those opponents who didn't discard a card with mana value 4 or greater, draw a card. So right away, it's a 4/2 flyer, an impactful body that does Chittering Rats, right? It takes one of their cards and potentially gives you a card. So potentially a 3 for 1 for 1 mana. Upside is there.
Yeah, the problem I think for me is this is like a value card, and these the deck that like a Hollow Marauder is going to go in is a deck that's very synergy based, and card advantage engines in those types of decks tend to not be very good because what you end up drawing more of is like Stitcher Suppliers and various cards with Surveil written on them that you insist are sweet and limited, as opposed to like drawing, you know, whatever Thoughtseizes and Shieldreds and things. Because you need to do a lot of work to turn this on. When you turn it on, like Dan says, this is a sweet sort of aggro creature. So discarding a card is bad. Getting to draw the card is really nice. And of course, after sideboard, this is a 7-mana card. So that's also kind of tough.
I mean, that raises the question of like, how much is this worth? It doesn't need to cost one, right? It's like a decent deal for three.
Yeah, it's a good question. Would we play this card if it was 3-mana? I think we would. I think I'd play this card.
What about 4-mana?
I would not play this card for 4-mana.
Even if it was a 3-for-1? Like, it seems better than that Ogre Inspector thing. It's just like, get your card back right away at least.
Well, this doesn't always get to draw a card, just so we're clear. Our opponents do get to play cards that cost 4 or more.
Okay.
And the later you play this, right, the... Well, that's not necessarily true. This does die to shock, so, you know, it's... I think it compares relatively favorably to the Ogre card. We dismiss the Ogre card immediately, and I'm at least considering this, so it's got to be better.
I mean, yeah, it's like, it looks cooler, first of all.
I agree with that.
Cost less. Great to be cycling with Blood for Bones and Citrus Suppliers, right? You just want to trigger this a bunch of times. It flies, so it actually, like, ends the game, which is something that I usually forget to do in these graveyard decks.
The flying part is the only reason I'm considering this. Like, a 4-power flyer is interesting.
Not the fact that it costs 1 mana?
Well, I don't think the 1 mana thing's that real. Like, playing Citrus Supplier is a huge cost. Like, Citrus Supplier is a bad card. So, like, that's a real red flag for me, is if we feel like we have to play a card like Citrus Supplier to play this. This card might be sweet, but, like, the cards around it are going to be very bad, so... Like, can we just play it with, like, the turtle or other, like, useful cards that mill and then just play this later in the game for, like, 2 mana, like, in a tempo-positive way? That's where I'm at.
Feels out of place in this set. Like, it feels like the kind of card that just is doing its own thing.
Yeah, which makes me wonder if it's, like, accidentally broken, right? Like, maybe it's just Stitcher Supplier, like, Deadly Dispute Stitcher Supplier and try to, like, hit a couple of these or something. Just try to get there.
I mean, I'm into that. Like,
well, we know you are. I knew this would be a card you like. That's why I wanted to talk about it. It can be very good. You have to play a bunch of shit cards that move stuff around in a bunch of zones.
Exactly. Like that, that 2/2 for 1 and a green that we talked about last time that mills 2 whenever you saddle.
Oh yeah. The badger.
Now I get to do my thing while attacking, which is new for me. It's... Yeah. All right. Progress.
But yeah, okay. I love that example though. Playing this with a badger and maybe the turtle is way more interesting to me than playing Stitcher Supplier. Like you just named a card that can actually that affects the board. The badger like attacks for 4 or 5 power. Stitcher Supplier never does anything. It can't saddle the badger, it can't block, it can't attack. It's a terrible draw every turn of the game except for maybe turn 1. So like, I think we're on to something when we start talking about, like, real cards that do stuff.
It's also not that much cost reduction in Pioneer. You know, this triggers up the Beanstalk if you want to revisit those concepts. There's probably something here where this is, like, one of the better ways to cheat on the curve. I don't know. We'll see. The fun addition.
Yeah.
And a surprising end to a very, very long set review. So I think we made it. I hope we didn't miss anything too important, David.
We did. I mean, my general takeaways here are that this set is going to be super impactful in Modern. It's going to be super impactful in Pioneer. And even though this is the set that makes the largest Standard format of all time, this is going to be super impactful in Standard. So it's interesting that Mark Rosewater said he thought Bloomburrow was going to be the set of the year because this set is super powered. I think this is a Dominaria Eldraine level power, especially on the cheaper cards. Like I said, when we got into 3-mana, there was a lot of clunky Legends, so I think they kind of were able to serve both masters. There's a bunch of terrible 3-mana legends that people can play in 100 card formats. That's awesome. Hopefully they have fun with them. And then a lot of the cheap cards are super pushed and should hopefully be interesting in a variety of constructed formats. You were not thinking the power level of the set is high. Have you come around a little bit, or are you still skeptical?
I think it's because the first wave of cards were all like legends and legendary enchantments. That combined with the spree cards. The spree cards, none of them can do anything for one mana, and that to me just like makes me feel like they can't be as good as they look. But once we kind of got past that, you know, I had to was reminded that everything is just like generically pushed. It just, you just get more than ever before these days. So it's not that the cards are not good. It's just like, I don't know what the competition is.
Yeah. I mean, we'll have to find out. I mean, the real interesting question is going to be, how good is plot?
Plot is like super fun. Like, I love how much different stuff they did with plot. The saddle, it seems pretty like one track. Like, they didn't really give you a lot of variety for points on the mana curve in which you could saddle things. Like, the fact that Mobile Homestead doesn't have a one mana mount to crew it is like very tilting for me. Just like all the mounts cost two. But then I think it's, you know, this extra bonus set of like mythic artifacts with weirdo effects. A lot of fodder for Enigma Jewel in this set, so it'll keep us busy.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
Indeed. So I think that does it for our set review, which means in our next episode we can already start to brew. I mean, any initial favorites here, David? Or
I mean, I'm pretty excited to play with Oko. I think that's like the fairest card I'm interested in. Everything else is pretty synergy based, which I find to be a little less interesting. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I've got 30 decks built, 35 decks. I mean, are they going to be good? Most of them will probably be quite bad. But yeah, there's just a bunch of super interesting cards in the set.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, so we'll leave it there, and we will be back next time when it's time to go take these into the queues. All right, take care, David.
All right, peace.